Welcome to Death Panel, where according to Sarah Palin, Barack Obama will decide whether or not to kill her parents and Down syndrome baby.
Please don't kill my parents and Down syndrome baby.
This panel sentences them to death.
This death panel is pure evil.
Evil.
Evil. Oh, it's just a horrible dream. Thank God we have a for-profit health insurance industry that never, ever denies health care to people. Am I right?
Poor people gonna rise up, take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
That was Look Back at Last Week in History, and you're about to hear This Week in Radical History for the week starting August 17th.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History is produced from the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Special thanks this week to the Radio Roots crew from WBAI in New York City for some audio that I'm borrowing for this week's show, an example of which you're about to hear right now. People, the time.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, August 17th in 1893, the controversial white American actress and playwright Mae West was born in Queens, New York. Mae West began her successful onstage career at a young age. She later wrote and starred in her first Broadway play entitled Sex, which riled up city officials and landed Mae West in jail for public obscenity. Her next play, The Drag, was about gay transgendered men and was completely banned from Broadway. Even in Hollywood, Mae West continued to shock the world with her risque and sexual material, and her work was constantly being censored. During her career, West performed two radio sketches that were apparently outrageous enough to panic the FCC and get her banned from the NBC network.
You go, girl.
Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you never let the past slip away.
Debunking the myth that America was founded on religious freedoms, on August 18th, 1634, Arbane Grandier is burned at the stake for being a witch. Also on August 18th, 1941, in a letter to President Roosevelt, Representative John Dingell suggests incarceration of 10,000 Hawaiian Japanese Americans as hostages to ensure, quote, good behavior on the part of Japan, unquote. Also on August 18th, 1977, South Africa, Steve Binko, a leading student apartheid resistor, was arrested in Port Elizabeth, later while in custody murdered. To quote Steve Binko, the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. Lastly, for August 18, 1996, the prison population rises to nearly 1.6 million inmates, double the number of a decade ago, the Justice Department said. This week in Radical History for August 19, 1503, Thou shall not kill. Well, tell that to Pope Alexander VI, who dies accidentally of poison intended for his guests. Also on this date in 1692 in the New World, five people, including the town's former minister, hung in Salem for witchcraft. There is a long list of religious persecution in the New World, like the followers of Thomas Morton, who set up a trading colony upstate from the Puritans' Plymouth colony. This colony was much more successful than the Puritans' colony, for they actually treated the area natives as friends rather than hated heathens. Morton's colony had a live-and-let-live attitude, which included a monthly dancing around the Maypole Dance celebration. The Puritans could have none of that, and struck down Morton's colony, destroying it by force. The long, long line of religious persecution in the New World not only included Morton's colony and supposed witches, but anyone not of the Puritans' faith, like Quakers, who were regularly forced out of the New World colonies. Yep, America's founded on religious freedom. True, as long as that religious is pious enough. Otherwise, they're destroyed by the evangelical zealots. Also on August 19, 1911, Mexican troops battle for the anarchist Zapatista-controlled cities. Also on that date, 1953, in Iran, Troops overthrow liberal-leaning premier and put the pro-Western dictator in power in a coup directed by the CIA, all to protect the American interests. Also on that date in 1958, NAACP Youth Council begins sit-in at desegregated lunch counters in Oklahoma. Also on that date in 1971, H.R. Haldeman, President Nixon's hatchet man, orders an FBI investigation of CIA news correspondent Danielle Shore, who had analyzed the president's speech, quote, unfavorably, unquote. Lastly, on August 19, 1989, South Africa Nobel Peace Prize winner Bishop Desmond Tutu are among hundreds of black demonstrators who are whipped and sandblasted by helicopters as they attempt to picnic on the white-only beaches near Cape Town. This week in Radical History for August 20th, 150 years plus before the official founding of America, on this date in 1619, the first group of 20 African slaves land in Jamestown, Virginia.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Maria Tumbawala. On this day, August 20th, in 1831, Nat Turner led a huge slave uprising in Southampton County, Virginia. The revolt began with only 6 followers, but eventually gained the support of approximately 60 slaves, who traveled from house to house murdering white slave owners and freeing slaves. 57 whites were killed. Although Nat Turner managed to escape the pursuing militia for 6 weeks, he was eventually arrested and brutally executed. In the months that followed, 55 black people suspected of being involved in Nat Turner's rebellion were executed and hundreds were beaten, tortured, and slaughtered by angry white mobs. While controversial, Nat Turner is viewed by many as a heroic symbol of black resistance to oppression. A little too militant for American Black History Month. Yeah, I said it.
Also on August 20th, 1886, sentences are handed down against the Haymarket trial defendants, found guilty despite obvious innocence. 7 anarchists are condemned to death. The hangings of the 7 innocent men will take place on November 11, 1887. Lastly, for August 20, 1998, U.S. cruise missiles pound targets in Sudan and Afghanistan and accidentally in Pakistan, targeting pharmaceutical industry factories, maker of anti-malaria and veterinarian drugs. Cruise missiles precisely target and destroy the factories. Quote, there is no sanctuary for terrorists and no limit to the resolve to defend American citizens and our interests, or our ideals of democracy and laws, unquote, says Clinton's U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen. Still later, the U.S. finally confessed that it erred in claiming that the plant was manufacturing and storing nerve gas or any link to Osama bin Laden, as was previously stated. Oops, my bad.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, August 21st, in 1971, Black Panther member and political prisoner George Jackson was shot dead by prison guards while attempting to escape from San Quentin Prison. At the time he was killed, Jackson was incarcerated for the murder of a white prison guard. The killing of the guard had been in retaliation for the earlier murder of 3 black activists in a nearby prison, in which case the guard was acquitted and the murders ruled justifiable homicide. Jackson had become politicized the first time he was locked up at the age of 18, and he quickly earned a reputation as a black revolutionary. There are even some speculations that the FBI was involved in the assassination of George Jackson as part of their COINTELPRO mission to eliminate all radical black social resistance. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for August 22nd, I only got a couple items. 1692, 8 more persons hung in Salem, Massachusetts, charged with witchcraft. Also on August 22nd, 1968, Remy Davis tells Chicago city officials it would be, quote, suicide, unquote, not to allow demonstrators during the Democratic National Convention to sleep in city parks. Tomorrow, Officer Friendly posts 11 p.m. curfew signs in park trees at Lincoln and Grand Parks. The whole world will be watching the Chicago police beating and gassing everyone and everybody they can get their hands on. Lastly, for August 22, 1972, police arrest 891 over 2 days as thousands of anti-war protesters disrupt the Miami Beach Convention of the Republican Party. People, the time's
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Maria Tumbawala. On this day, August 22nd, in 1989, black activist Huey P. Newton was shot dead while walking along a street in Oakland, California. Newton had become involved with campus activism while attending Oakland City College years earlier. After connecting with Bobby Seale, the two organized the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in 1966. The organization's radical view against the oppressive social structure of the American government and its confrontation of Oakland's racist police force gained them a quick reputation with the FBI. After his release from a short stint in prison, Newton renounced political violence and forced his activism on beneficial community outreach programs. Newton was allegedly murdered by a drug dealer, and the media used this idea to rip apart Newton's reputation and devalidate him as a positive community leader. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for August 23rd, 1500, New World. Christopher Columbus, accused of mistreatment of natives in Haiti, is arrested and sent back to Spain in chains. Could have threw him overboard and saved us a lot of trouble. Also on August 23rd, 1911, Ishi, last member of a Stone Age tribe in the Americas, discovered in California. For a great book about Ishi coming out of the wilderness into the white world, see the book Ishi of Two Worlds. Also on August 23, 1917, riots occur in Houston, Texas, when the 24th Infantry seeks revenge to the city's white police after a brutal beating of two black regimental soldiers. After 2 hours of violence, 15 whites, including four policemen, are killed and 18 more are injured. Four soldiers died. 118 soldiers are charged in connection with the riots, and 19 are executed, most in almost total secrecy, in one of the most infamous court-martials ever involving African-Americans. More short items for August 23rd. 1946. Three white men are fined $10 in Collins, Mississippi, for the attempted rape of three black women at gunpoint. And justice for all. Also on that date in 1962, always with a hard-on for Castro, JFK administration approves a massive covert sabotage effort against Cuba. Lastly, for August 23rd, 1996, today the net worth of the world's 358 richest people equal the combined income of the poorest 45% of the world's population. That's 2.3 billion people. Once again, way back in 1996, and it's gotten worse since then, 358 people have as much wealth as 2.3 billion people.
Everybody has to pay taxes. Even businessmen that rob and steal and cheat from people every day. Even they have to pay taxes.
You have been listening to This Week in Radical History. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Calendar Organizer, and more radical historical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Speaking of inspiration, some down peeps that produced Anarchy Now are also doing a live weekly anarchist ditty. Check out Bottom Up Radio Network or BURN each and every Sunday night starting at 8 p.m. Central Time Zone. And the place you can tune into this anarcho-radical perspective is blogtalkradio.com/rabble. Again, Sundays, 8 p.m. at blogtalkradio.com/RABBLE. Got the bolt. We leave you musically this week with Holy, 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 but this last reminder that I never really leave you, for I'm forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
The world is
anarchist affiliation that have been causing problems of breaking windows, rioting throughout the town.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We know that the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS, is enjoying enormous success, if for no other reason than it has become the target of an aggressive and well-financed campaign promoting anti-BDS legislation by the infamous Jewish lobby at both the state and national level. Originally, the BDS campaign was scoffed at by both the Israeli government and the lobby as weak and ineffectual, but no more. BDS is gaining enormous momentum, and the response now is to try to somehow outlaw it. Fortunately, the U.S. Constitution seems to be standing in their way, although they are trying several creative ways to get around it, so far quite unsuccessfully. Ali Abu Nima, writing in the Electronic Intifada, wrote the following concerning the latest legislative attempt in the U.S. Senate. Senator Elizabeth Warren has announced she opposes the Israeli Anti-Boycott Act. I think the boycott is wrong, but I think outlawing protected free speech activity violates our basic constitutional rights, Warren told constituents at a rally in Revere, Massachusetts. After slamming the bill, Warren turned to Catherine Clark, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, who shared the stage with her, and asked her, "Do you feel the same?" When Clark apparently signaled assent, Warren said to the audience, "Good, we've got two of us here." Warren's opposition to the bill comes after her fellow Democrat, New York's Senator Kristen Gillibrand, pulled her sponsorship from the legislation last week. The American Civil Liberties Union wrote to members of Congress last month, urging them to oppose the bill, which it termed a direct violation of the First Amendment. As first reported by the Electronic Intifada in April, the Israeli Anti-Boycott Act is the most draconian of the dozens of bills introduced in state and federal legislatures in recent years in an attempt to curb the growth of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS, movement for Palestinian rights. The powerful Israeli lobby, AIPAC, has made the bill one of its top legislative priorities. As Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights explains, the bill would impose fines of up to $1 million and criminal penalties of up to 20 years in prison against any U.S. person, including individuals, whose actions further a boycott of Israel or of Israeli settlement products called for by an international governmental organization. Rubner adds, It would even criminalize the requesting or furnishing of information about such a boycott. The bill would also deny government loans through the Export-Import Bank to firms that refuse to do business with corporations based in or operating out of Israeli settlements in occupied territory, which are illegal under international law. Despite her reputation as a firebrand progressive, Warren has never been courageous on the question of Palestinian rights. Nothing symbolized her fear better than when she was caught on video hurrying away from a question about Israel's assault on Gaza 3 years ago that killed more than 2,200 Palestinians. Warren, along with fellow progressive stalwart Bernie Sanders, joined other members of the Senate in signing a letter in April reaffirming key lobby talking points that Israel is being unfairly picked by efforts at the UN to hold it accountable. Her opposition to BDS means she continues to stand against a nonviolent movement for equal rights by a people subjected to decades of Israeli occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid, enabled largely by U.S. military and political support. But Warren's willingness to oppose this bill reflects the ongoing challenge to Democratic Party leaders from a base that is far more supportive of Palestinian rights. It also recalls a warning in a leaked report from a prominent Israeli lobby group earlier this year that anti-BDS laws are raising concerns over violations of free speech, which may alienate potential supporters of Israel. Other lawmakers are being challenged over their support of the bill, too. As Mondo Rice reported, Ron Wyden, a Democratic senator from Oregon, was repeatedly challenged over his support for it at a town hall meeting in Portland. Wyden, who has a reputation for supporting civil rights, got flustered by hecklers and questioners, Mondo Weiss observed. The senator conceded that the impetus for the bill was in fact that the boycott movement has grown. That was excerpts from an article by Ali Abunima in the Electronic Intifada. But while both Senator Warren and Representative Clark made a modest move in voicing opposition to this latest Senate bill based on First Amendment concerns, they have not been able to go all the way and voice their support for BDS. They obviously still consider that touching the third rail of American politics. We have work to do with our congressional delegation, and that's for sure. Okay, moving on. This week we feature a conversation with a remarkable Palestinian educator who is pioneering an effort to promote the use of a unique approach to therapy called expressive therapy in a society that experiences constant trauma living under Israeli military occupation. Hitam Edelby is working on her PhD at Lesley University, where she also received her bachelor's and master's degrees. She lives in East Jerusalem, but grew up in the Aqqa area of Israel as part of the 20% of the Israeli population who are Palestinian Arabs. You will hear her story, and you will hear about how she is using expressive therapies to help her people cope with the stress of living under military occupation. We spoke together in Cambridge just hours before she boarded her flight back home after spending the summer working on her doctorate at Lesley. Hitam, welcome back to This Week in Palestine. This is your third appearance on the show, and you're here in Cambridge this summer finishing your second year in the PhD program at Lesley University.
Your field is expressive therapies. You already have your master's degree and are doing some amazing work in Palestine, which we will get to in a minute. But first, tell us what expressive therapies is and why you think it is especially important to use in Palestine.
It is basically using different kind of art and therapy. And in my case, because I had the multi-program where we had music, dance, movement, drama, theater, and painting, and writing as well. And we are using that, all kind of that, in our work. I'm using it in my work when I work with children and teachers and even younger children as well. So the reason I use more than one kind of art is because some people like to do kind of art, but they don't like to do the other kind of art. Like, for example, I work with women who like to do some drama, but some other women don't like to do drama. They want to do dance or drumming or painting. So we have that variety that we offer and we provide to the groups, and each can use the art he likes or she likes to do. And the reason I find it very important in Palestine, because it is basically tools to express yourself. We use it to express ourselves. And kids, adolescents as well, need to do that in Palestine under the circumstancing that stands we live in, and the rough and the tough situation. It's like a tool to open ourselves and to talk about ourselves and to talk about the harsh and complicated and difficult situation we live in under the occupation. And in some cases, we manage to help kids and adults to use art in that. And when they don't want to do art, I give them the opportunity just to express that verbally. And when they feel that they have the need to do art and they want to do art, I always provide the art, and I always have the art with me. And
Well, how do they get to you, or how do you get to them? Who are the kids and the families that you work with?
In some cases, I seek the kids, and in some cases, the kids seek me. Mm-hmm. Like when I work with the Bedouin sector, I seek volunteers who come from the villages, and the volunteers help me reach out and help me go to the villages and do work with the villages inside the village. So I get my car and I fill my car with art supplies, sometimes also toys and games, and I go to the village and I do the activities with the help from volunteers, and I do the activities within the village with the children inside their neighborhood. In other case, I go to the schools. Like I do some work in one of UNRWA schools in Qalandia refugee camp. I contacted the school and the counselor there, and I offered my project to do expressive art with a group of adolescents there. And the school with the principal and the counselor welcomed the idea. And I went for around 5 months weekly session. Each session went for almost 3 hours. So we sat and talked, and we did art, and we played some games and toys. And the idea was to give them the opportunity to talk about themselves, and when they wanted to do that through the painting or the drawing or the music, they were allowed to do that as well.
So the young people in Palestine are really a traumatized
group, the young people living under military occupation, seeing the military in the streets almost every day.
I think it's beyond traumatized. It's not like they were traumatized. They live under ongoing trauma, because no way what to expect. I mean, you open your eyes, you want to go to head to school or to work, but you, for a single minute, you can't guarantee whether you will reach the school or the work or the visit or the shopping, because outside the house, you never know what's going to happen. You don't know whether the road will be open or not. You don't know whether the checkpoint will be open or not. So you plan your plan. You have your view. You have your plan that you want to go for. But you can't be 100% sure that your plan will be will become real.
And these boys, you were particularly interested in them because of the...
I've been, I was, I'm still, and I think I will be all the time, interested in this population, the adolescents population. I believe that it is somehow very neglected population in Palestine. And they are, in many cases, called the troublemakers. And the reason they are neglected or abandoned sometimes is because we, the adults, we, the educators, or we, the parents, don't know how to deal with them. So I try as much as I can to seek and work with them, and I love it, and I think they are very creative, and in this particular age, they become even more and more creative when they get the opportunity to be creative and to use their time in a good way and in a positive way.
Now, you do not work for a particular school or institution.
No,
you
I'm freelancer.
You're freelance, and you operate out of your car, and you're on the road constantly.
4 days a week.
Right.
Yeah.
And you go into these communities or these schools or institutions or whatever, and you begin work, but who do you work with? And after you work with this particular group, then what happens? Are the people there to pick up their work? Are you training people to do the work so that when you leave, it continues?
Yeah. I always have somebody with me. Like when I work with the group in the school, the counselor is there. In most cases, he participates in all activities. And when I am not there, he also conducts similar activities or kind of activities to the activities I do with them. But also the people are creative. They also create the counselors also create new things and establish new programs. But they do get training from me, like volunteers in the Bedouin sectors. When they volunteered with me last year, they were with me almost every week. So we work together. It's not like they were just witnessing my work.
Right.
They did
so
the work.
So you're training, you're constantly...
Yeah, it is like sharing and volunteering and witnessing and training, yeah.
How long do you usually commit to a community like that? You go into a community...
Minimum 5 months.
5 months?
Minimum.
That's...
Yeah.
I see. Five months.
It's not like... It's not that like, I go there once a year or twice a
right.
year, and then I jump to another place. I like the long-term programs so I can build something and this thing gets settled. I don't say that what I leave behind is 100% perfect. There is no perfect. But I do feel that after a couple of months, the people there get the idea, get the core, and they get the goal of the expressive art, and they can continue. They need the materials, and they need sometimes the space, and they need the ability to continue. But so many people love the program, and so many people get into it, and so many people, like Hamda in Arab al-Jahalin village. She created, she established her own project right now. And she just graduated from school only a couple of months ago.
From what level school?
She went to the university and mm-hmm. she became social worker. Mm-hmm. And she graduated three months ago. Last year she volunteered with me in the Bedouin villages. And after she graduated, she said, Khitam, I want to establish my own project in my own village. Would you help me? I said, of course I will help you. So she was looking in the village and she found an abandoned trailer that was used before for certain activities. Not anymore. They closed it because it wasn't funded.
I see.
So she took it. She cleaned it, I helped her, and we got some stuff, and I helped her with some money, and we got art supplies, toys and games, used furniture, and we started. Since then, she is in the trailer twice a week, one day for children and one day for women. Some women come and volunteer with her and help her. And they are doing fine. During Al-Fitr feast, they had 60 kids who came and they played and had fun and did art. So,
Hamda, how did she already had access to the kids and the kids came?
Yeah,
and they return. They
come. They go every Monday. Uh-huh. Yes, after school. During the school year, they go from 1 to 3 afternoon, because they have to be in the school in the morning time, and so they go after school. But now in the summertime, they go in the morning from 10 to 12, 12:30. And when I go back this week, I will go visit her and see how we're going to continue the work. And I will continue my work. I will continue helping her once a week for the whole coming year.
So that in this Bedouin village, this is not a part of the school. This is an extracurricular activity. This is something the kids
yes.
come to voluntarily.
Yeah.
They hear about it and they
yep.
come and they keep
yep.
coming.
Yep.
They keep coming back.
Yeah. It locates in the middle of the village, not far from a kindergarten and not far from the school, but it is not related. I mean, Hamda collaborates with the school and the kindergarten because she needs water and electricity from them for the trailer. But it is a separate project. It's not related to the school.
Okay, so, and you will work with this village for, let's say,
This coming year. Yes.
So you've committed to an entire year to
yeah.
work with this.
At least 8 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, hopefully, when you leave, there will be a group of people sort of steeped in and trained.
Hopefully.
And
hopefully,
they will
but
continue.
They do need, yeah, hopefully. They do need the support to do so.
Yeah.
So far, Hamda works with no money. She has no salary. She
yeah.
gets no salary. So she is doing this from her, you know, her time. And she is loving it, I mean, and she enjoys it. And she is seeking for fund. She's seeking fund. So hopefully if she gets some fund, this will also push her to continue and get some salary, you know, to live from as well. So this will encourage her more and more.
So are most of your projects like that? You go and then they have to raise money to
yeah.
keep it going? You have to
yeah.
raise money for
yeah.
supplies?
Yeah, I'm trying to help in that. We have another counselor who is very close, a friend to us, and he was her counselor when she did school, Nasser Hamamra. He is very, very generous and he is very smart and he is so much into helping Palestinian projects when it comes to the schools or after school programs. And he also will volunteer to do some work with her and he will give sessions either weekly or monthly, I'm not sure yet. But he's going to be very good support for her as well.
And it's the same story for you. You're not working, you're not on anyone's payroll, as I understand it.
No,
you have to raise your own money.
I am. This is what I'm doing.
Yes.
Yes.
And so there's real pressure here to be able to maintain the resources. This program takes a lot of resources. art supplies, yeah. to say nothing about the gas for travel and all that's behind this. And all this is raised in sort of in the private sector. There's no NGO involved here. Is that right?
Correct.
Correct. Now, in Palestine, is expressive therapies taught anywhere in the university? Is it used very well?
Unfortunately, not in any university. Mm-hmm. But since I graduated in 2009, and I was back to Palestine. Be honest, I found that so many people welcoming the program. Mm. I taught it in different schools, and I offered it in many organizations, and I trained till now probably 400 to 500 teachers.
So
I go to the organization or I go to the institute and I offer my project, and they think about it and they seek the money for it and they hire me to do the project. So some projects I go for 3 months, some projects takes 6 months. So the institution or the organization or the school gets the fund for the project. So I do the project, I get paid from them, but after I finish, they don't continue because they have no one, unless the teachers who are trained, who were trained with me, are teaching at the same school, and they do continue the project.
So that in Palestine, you're really a pioneer in this effort. I mean, expressive therapies is relatively new, and it is
new, and we have probably another 3 or 4 expressive art therapists maximum.
3 or 4?
Maximum. And the other side of Palestine, in Palestine 48, like in Haifa, Akka, Galilee, you find more art therapists because they do it at the Israeli universities.
Mm-hmm.
The Israeli universities.
So they have institutional backing.
Yes, the Israeli universities offer the program, but not the Palestinian. And this is my hope and this is my goal, to have this program in our university and in the Palestinian universities as well.
Okay, I want to get to that in a minute. How did you get into expressive therapies? How did you hear about it? How did you get turned on to it?
In 2004, January 2004, I used to work at the Palestinian Counseling Center. Dr. Julia Byers from Lesley University, who at that time was the head of the PhD program, came to Palestine and came to the center, and she wanted to go to Jenin refugee camp to work with women and young women who lost their husbands or siblings during the massacre 2 years before, in 2002, when the Israeli military invaded the camp and demolished around 100 houses, and many were killed. So Julia Byers spoke no Arabic, and she needed someone to go with her who could translate. And we went in a very hard, secret way, but we did it. And we were there for 2 days, and for 2 days she worked with probably 15 women, helped him writing stories and singing songs and writing poems and creating artwork about themselves, for themselves, about their husbands, for their husbands. And it was fascinating. It fascinated me and amazed me what she did and how they opened themselves and how they talked about their loss and how they grieved their grief. And there, in Jenin refugee camp, I asked myself, if Dr. Julia Byers, who doesn't speak any Arabic single word, could do this with my people, I can do this with my people.
So you really saw the, quote, therapy work.
Yes.
You really saw change.
Yes.
In just 2 days.
In 2 days.
And enough so you said, this is what I want to do.
I told Julia the same night, I am considering Lesley. I want to come to Lesley. And Dr. Julia looked at me and said, I already see you there.
That's wonderful.
This is what happened.
Yeah.
Since then, I said, I'm coming to Leslie.
You came to Leslie.
Yep.
And you got your master's.
Yeah.
You're 2 years into your doctorate.
Yep. Starting the second year. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Where do you see a program like this going? You want to get your doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to go back to Palestine, obviously.
I am in Palestine.
You are in Palestine. Yeah. And what's your vision for your future? You have another year of another summer. You'll be here in Cambridge at Leslie.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll take a year or so for your thesis. You're,
mm-hmm.
you're working on
mm-hmm.
that, getting that together. And you will graduate.
Yep.
Hopefully
2 years from today. Hopefully.
2 years.
Yeah.
And then what? What do you see as your vision having a PhD going back to Palestine? You obviously saw the need to get your PhD. Now what do you want to do with it?
The need came from more than one reason. I really hope I can teach at the Palestinian universities.
Mm-hmm.
And having PhD may give me more chance or open more doors for me to do so. The second thing is that the research itself, I mean, I'm doing my research about, I believe, a unique subject with a unique population. I'm exploring or experiencing playback theater with adolescents in the refugee camp, in Qalandia refugee camp. And playback theater is a unique art form.
Tell us about playback.
Playback theater is the theater where one of the audience, we call him the teller, tells his personal story, and the actors act the story on the spot, improvise the story in front of him. After that, they go back to the teller and ask him about his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And he reflects to what he witnessed, to what he saw, and how the story that he saw was close and related to the story he told. And this has therapeutic element. And usually people bring stories that touch them and talk to them and come from them and has something deep in them. And when they bring it to the audience, when they bring it to the stage, it's like sharing others, telling others about my own story.
And there's real therapeutic value in that.
There is, yes, definitely.
So your thesis is going to be sort of
about exploring how adolescents in the refugee camps tell their personal stories through playback theater.
And you're going back. You'll be doing this coming year. You'll be working on
this coming year. I will have to start my pilot study that I will conduct and. At the Freedom Theater in Jenin refugee camp, where they do playback theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to interview some of adolescents who are doing playback theater and facilitators who are training them in this art form. For my research, I will work directly with small group of adolescents and do with them playback theater. So this is the main research mm-hmm. 2 years from today. But the pilot research will be based on interviews at the Freedom Theater. And this is the only theater in Palestine where they do teach and conduct and present playback theater.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your goal is to teach at the university level. Your goal, obviously, is to train teachers to do this, people to do this?
I am doing that. But I will take it to maybe to extra level, to a higher level.
Will you need to sell universities on this? I mean, are the universities, or do you know people within the university structure that know expressive therapies?
I do. I did already some contacts, mm-hmm. and I met with the head of the drama section at Bethlehem University and the education department at Beer Zeit University, and we had we didn't get in much details, but it was a brief introduction, and hopefully when I come back this summer I will meet with them again and see what we can do together. If not this year, maybe after I graduate.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you go back, besides working on the PhD and the stand-up theater project, you will be working with the Bedouin community.
Yes.
And you continue to work with a number of other communities that you've been working with right along, right? How many groups are you working with, or how many?
During the week, I work with four different groups. One group that has children from the Bedouin sector,
mm-hmm.
the adolescents group in Qalandia refugee camp, the teachers a group that I usually train at a center where they qualify teachers for schools, and the fourth group will be the women group.
Mm-hmm.
The women group, some of them are mothers of martyrs, and they live between Qalandia checkpoint, Qalandia refugee camp, and Ramallah, in that area that we call Qalandia, Samiramis, Kufr Aqab, and locates on the road between Ramallah and Qalandia refugee camp. So the women, group of women between 10 to 12. I did that last year, and I hopefully I will do this mm-hmm. year as well. It's a weekly session where we also do art, but we also sometimes just talk and tell stories and talk about self and about life, about what they face with their children and the children who are in the prisons. Some of them even lost their children. Their children were killed recently during the last couple of years. So some of them, they are still grieving and full of mm-hmm. sadness and full of heaviness, but they all evaluated in very positive way our sessions last year. They found that it was a space to talk and mm-hmm. to cry and to be themselves and to talk about their loss and to laugh sometimes and to sing loss sometimes and to get some happiness sometimes. It's mm-hmm. not only. It's not all about just sadness things, because we do have to help them. I try as much as I can to help them capture positive points in our life and good things in our life, what's left in our life, to continue. We mm-hmm. have to continue. We have to keep on. Life goes on, and we can't bury ourselves with our kids. Our kids are buried. We have to continue mm-hmm. with those who are still alive. If we buried our husband, we still have the kids, we have siblings, we have families, we have friends, and we have life that have to keep on. So,
In some of the first communities that you work with, or the first groups you work with, you, I take it in a sense, finished with some of them.
Mm-hmm.
You left behind people of, hopefully will continue the work,
mm-hmm.
teachers, parents, et cetera, mm-hmm. continue to do it. Has that been successful to your knowledge? Are most of these still going of your...
I can't tell that all the volunteers or the people who worked with me are doing the same. First mm-hmm. of all, they don't have to do the same anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They have to do it in their own way. I mean,
right.
they capture what they capture, mm-hmm. they take what they get, they take what they take, and they do it in their own way. But I do strongly believe that some, yes, are doing art therapy and some believing in it, and some actually thinking about taking more courses and more training with me. Some women are conducting what they had with me with other women, and I know from many teachers who got trained with me, who took long-term sessions with me, are doing this with their kids in school. This is for sure.
Yeah, because it seems to me that what you're doing is you're building a movement, really. You're building a movement where expressive therapies are seen as important to growth and to therapy, to getting through these traumatized situations. And Palestine, there's no more traumatized society on the face of the earth than Palestine. It seems to me that this is going to be very, very important when you go to a university and you say, we need in Palestine expressive therapies, we need to grow the movement, we need to train, we need to teach, etc. We need universities to do this, and this is what I want to do. It seems to me that this movement will be very, very important for you to say, look what we've done. Look what we've done with nothing, almost. Look, you know, with no institution behind us, we've built this movement.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that's the picture you're painting.
The reason I could go back to Palestine after my graduation and start my own institution or my own NGO. I didn't want to do that. We have plenty. We have tons of NGOs in Palestine. Mm-hmm. I didn't think we need more than we had. And I thought that if I manage to reach them, why to have a new one, since I can get my program and get this new art form through what's we have in Palestine, through our schools and through the organizations that they are already there and through the universities? Why to establish, why to create a special center for expressive art therapy when we can get it through other centers and through other universities or through other schools?
Yeah, that's so you're going. So that's why it's becoming a movement all through this. It's not located in a place.
No, it's not located.
It's located in many places.
Yeah, that's how I believe in it, and that's why I have my mobile art car, and that's how the whole idea of the mobile art bus started. That we don't locate in one place, and we don't wait to the people to come to us. We reach out, we reach the people, we go to the people, we go to where we know there is a big need. And this is what I'm doing so far for 9 years almost.
You at one point were talking about trying to get into Gaza to do the same kind of thing.
I tried many times. Yeah. I asked, and for me, with the Israeli passport, it's almost impossible. Yeah. I am Palestinian, carry the Israeli passport because this is the only document I can have, but it doesn't allow me to get it. It needs a lot of process, and it needs to have so many contacts. And because I don't belong to any institution, I don't work with Save the Children, or I don't work with UNRWA, these big names, these big bags that they can back up you. I don't think I will never, ever get a chance to get to Gaza unless one of the big ones say, yeah, we want you and we're going to help you and let's get into Gaza. Mm. It's my dream. I would love to.
Yeah. Okay, well, it sounds like you've got a lot on your plate, and we know that because we're in touch with you year-round, and we know the work you're doing with the kids. We know how hard this PhD program is. We watched you with that. It's been a long time. How many years now have you been coming to Lesley?
I did 4 years between 2005 and 2009. Mm-hmm. I completed first my bachelor's and immediately started the master's. So I went for 4 years. 2009, I was back to Palestine, and last year, 2016, I was back to do the to start the PhD program that should take maximum 4 years, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. So you'll be back next summer?
And the summer after for graduation.
Summer after for graduation.
If everything is done by then, yes.
Yeah. Well, congratulations and thanks very
much.
We've watched this grow, and it's amazing work. And we know the need that it's fulfilling in the Palestinian society. We hear your stories, and we're very grateful that you're there, as I'm sure are the Palestinian people.
Thank you so much.
That was a conversation with Kitam Edelby, an expressive therapist living and working in the West Bank of Palestine. And that is it for this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
Yes.
Okay, sound check. Check 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Broadcasting from the most confused, dumbed down, manipulated, and brainwashed nation on the face of the planet with the news they hope and pray you never hear.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. ...14 innocent civilian tourists and locals killed in Barcelona by the killer van. Will people stop visiting Spain now like they have stopped visiting Yemen, Libya and Syria in the context of the perpetual war, which is not meant to be won? Just generate unlimited profits for arms firms. We pull Europe's latest terrorist attack apart from yesterday in Barcelona, what we know so far. Also, China locking up a young pro-democracy Hong Kong MP and other pro-democracy campaigners in Hong Kong. Plus, carried over from last week, another 9/11 scholar. This week it's the turn of Jim Mars, author of Rule by Secrecy, amongst many other books, who sadly died last week in Fort Worth, Texas. Our sister show Dialects back again on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week a whole show devoted to old Bristol buses and the Bristol Omnibus Vehicle Collection. Buses made here at the Bath Road factory of Bristol Commercial Vehicles and shipped all over the world. And you'll get what's probably the only chance to see them in Bristol this year on the second weekend in September at Open Doors Day, when they'll be based up at Flowers Hill in Brislington, running people back and forth to the Open Doors venues. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or if you can't wait, download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. First, Martin, what have you been looking at this week?
Obviously I've been aware of the Barcelona attack, but we're going to cover that in a moment. Obviously the Charlottesville business in the US. I did an interview for Rush Today about that last Sunday.
Well, what did you say?
Well, we were still finding out what was going on. We've got to recognise that the deep state in the US is encouraging social conflict both in the US and elsewhere, and that we shouldn't take at face value exactly what's going on here. There is quite possibility. There's a possibility that both sides are being infiltrated and manipulated. So, for example, one of the organisers of the right-wing protest about the Robert E. Lee statue was actually a part of the Occupy movement some years ago, and he seems to have completely changed his spots and gone to the other side.
Suggestions by Susan Lindau that he's an agent provocateur.
Well, that may be the case. There may be agent provocateurs operating within both groups,
and that would fit
the pattern of what we know about how NATO intelligence services operate.
First of all, what is an agent provocateur?
Well, an agent provocateur is somebody who joins a political group in order to try and basically make them do more extreme things so that they can then be, blamed, rounded up, neutralised, etc. So, in the past, there was a book called What Everybody Should Know About State Repression, which was written by a Russian called... I've forgotten the name now, but people can look it up. And of course, one of the things that everybody should know about state repression is that the state infiltrates people into groups in order to encourage bad behaviour, which they can then use against the groups concerned and the causes that they're pursuing. And we've got to remember that we now know that the British police force, for example, since 1968, the Special Demonstration Squad has got hundreds of members, and they were busily infiltrating lots of groups. So people say this doesn't go on. We've got evidence that it does, and we know it does.
This book you're talking about is by Victor Serge.
That's right, Victor Serge.
The Secrets of Provocation. It says the recruitment and operation of agent provocateurs, external surveillance being followed, and problems of illegality.
Yeah, it was written in the early part of the 20th century, and he also wrote a book about the Russian Revolution, in which he participated, called Birth of Our Power. And he's
1979.
Well, that's maybe when it was published, but it was written a long time before that, I think.
Well, not according to this. First edition, 1979. But anyhow,
all right.
So what about the wider issues to do with Charlottesville? Because this is all about statues and about pulling down statues. Now, there is a sort of similar talk in Bristol, isn't there, in a kind of here and there, about the statue of Edward Colston, this kind of thing. And, of course, we've seen this time and time again. Statue of Gaddafi pulled down, statue of Saddam Hussein pulled down. It seems that this is something that's supposedly incredibly important about this. I mean, a lot of people look at a statue and say, so what?
Well, I think the fact of the matter is what's happened in Richmond, Virginia, is that the local council, in its wisdom, has decided that it doesn't want the statue there anymore, and they don't want the park to be called the Lee Park Lee anymore. They want it to be called Emancipation Park. And that was because of agitations by people on the left at the University of Virginia and within that community of Charlottesville.
This goes back to the 1840s, 1850s.
Well, no, in actual fact, most of these Confederate statues of Confederate generals and politicians went up in the 1920s.
No, but what about the actual why they're there?
No,
Let me just explain to you, Tony. War, yeah.
Let me just explain to you. After the Civil War, the defeated Confederacy was not allowed to put statues up of the people that had fought for the Confederacy. In fact, people in the North would have gone bonkers if a Robert E. Lee statue had gone up. Don't forget, we've just smashed completely the Confederacy. You've had to free the slaves.
It's a little bit like, say, in the 1950s, putting up an Adolf Hitler picture.
Exactly. So, in other words, these statues do not date back to that era, because in that era they would have been so controversial that nobody would have dared to put them up. They were mostly put up in the 1920s, when a resurgent right-wing racist movement in the South wanted to reclaim the Confederate history of the South. And at that time, they managed to put these statues up, even though they wouldn't have been allowed to put them up previously. And now, of course, the pendulum's swinging in the other direction, and people saying, well, what are these statues doing here? They represent slavery, they represent oppression. They went up in the 1920s when many blacks were still denied the vote in this part of the world, and so on. So, in other words, it's a symbolic battle between the left and the right. But in Richmond itself, the local council has decided, as a local council is perfectly entitled to do, to take the statue away and to change the name of the park. Now, some people may not like that, but then ultimately the decision about statues is a decision for local councils, and it's a planning decision. And ultimately we might decide in this city, through our collective wisdom, to remove the statue of Colston, or we might not. But the point is that it's our decision to make either way. And you can't just say statues that are there have always got to stay there. What about all the statues of Lenin all over Eastern Europe? There must have been thousands and thousands of them. Are they all supposed to stay there forever?
Let's get back to the Civil War, though, which is where a lot of these sentiments begin.
Yeah.
Was it really just about slavery?
No. No, it wasn't. It was about a number of different issues. But the point...
I mean, it was basically the Confederate states were the slave states.
Yes.
They were... really, slavery, I suppose you could sum it up in businessmen, landowners, etc., that didn't really want to pay any wages at all for cheap labour. They just wanted to have slaves instead, and they didn't want to give them up.
Yes, and many people in the North felt that was unfair competition for people who weren't slaves. So that was one of the reasons why, you know, the relatively quite racist people of the time didn't like slavery in the South, because they thought it was undercutting their own wages, which, of course, it was.
And how long did it go for?
It started when the English first arrived in North America in the 1600s. And it gradually became more and more important. The thing that made slavery really important was the discovery that tobacco could be grown and ultimately cotton could be grown, and that became incredibly profitable. But you can only really grow those crops with a huge workforce, and that workforce had to come from somewhere. They were brought in from Africa, and it became, you know, it became a very profitable, very successful setup. You were then in a situation where the vested interests involved did not want to see that changed under any circumstances.
But what do you make about this whole thing of taking down statues? Is that a good idea, or is it just something that should be decided by governments?
It should be decided.
The thing is, of course, I mean, for example, in the English Civil War, we had Charles I's head chopped off, mm-hmm. and yet I think in a way quite sensibly didn't take down all the statues of Charles I. In fact, finish my sentence. There's a very famous one outside Charing Cross Station.
Well, in the Commonwealth, when Cromwell was in charge, no statues of King Charles were put up. And of course, what eventually happened is the Royalists reasserted themselves, and at that point, those statues were safe. But the question of what statues should or shouldn't be there is a decision for local communities.
A little story about that statue of King Charles I. After the parliamentary victory in the English Civil War, the statue was sold to a metalsmith in the Holborn area called John Rivett. Rivett received instructions from Parliament to break down the statue, but instead he hid it on his premises. It is said he buried it. He produced some broken pieces of brass as evidence that he followed his instructions. And for some time, solid brass-handled cutlery sold brass-handled cutlery to both royalists and parliamentarians, which he claimed was made from the remains of the statue. But after the restoration, the statue was found by Jerome Weston, the second Earl of Portland. Following a complaint to the House of Lords, it was decreed the said John Rivett shall permit and suffer the Sheriff of London to serve a plevin, whatever that is, upon the said statue, now in his custody. It was purchased by the king, 1675, placed outside Charing Cross Station. So, you know, it really is about this history being written by the winners, isn't it, effectively?
Yes.
And it was only because of the restoration that that statue got put back.
That's right. Well, I think, you know, would people be happy to have statues of Stalin around Britain? No, they probably wouldn't. So you've got to,
Wasn't it Stalin that pretty much won the Second World War?
Well, yes, and you might argue that we should have statues of him. But, I mean, the point is you've got masses and masses of statues in central London of various Victorian generals who all they really did was go and basically rape and pillage around the world. And ultimately, you've got to make a decision. Do you want those statues to stay? You don't necessarily have to destroy the statues. I mean, there's a museum at Kozłówka near Lubartów in Poland, and it's basically a stately home, but the one of the barns near it has been absolutely filled up with statues from the communist era in Poland. But they're not there in the central square anymore, because having the central square dominated by communist statues was just not the mood of the moment in the 1990s when Poland became a democracy. And therefore, you've got to allow the possibility that there's going to be a change in street furniture. You know, you're not necessarily going to have the same statues today as you had yesterday, and it's a question of for local decision makers to make.
Well, okay, let's bring this back to Colston and Thomas Clarkson. It was the famous abolitionist who started the committee in Bristol, which finally did get the slave trade, at least the official slave trade anyway, abolished. So why is there no statue to him?
Well, because there's inevitably a bias in statues towards the dominant political interests in the society. They're the ones who've got the resources and the clout.
Surely the dominant interest after the abolition was that.
Well, no, the dominant interest remained. I mean, don't forget that the people who owned slaves were all compensated, given full compensation for their slaves, which were freed in Jamaica and elsewhere. And that was then paid for by taxes on tobacco and booze, which were paid for by white people in Britain. And so, in actual fact, there are loads of families, like the Gladstone family, started their whole career as entrepreneurs in the Industrial Revolution on the back of a big handout for all the slaves themselves didn't get anything. They just got, you know, the right to be free, but they didn't get compensated for being a slave. Yes. The slave owners were compensated.
The right to wage slavery.
Yeah.
Effectively.
But, I mean, the point is that the what tends to happen in societies is that the physical infrastructure represents, inevitably, the interests of the dominant groups within the society. And it only changes very occasionally. And when it does, then people may say, well, we don't want those statues there anymore. We want different statues.
The abolitionists actually are pretty much celebrated in places like the Caribbean, in places like Haiti, etc.
Well, exactly.
A lot of these people have got statues there, but no Edward Colston statue.
Yes, and I'm sure that the Edward Colston statue, if there were any in the Caribbean, wouldn't last 5 minutes. But the point is, pulling statues down without any kind of, you know, because there's been some groups that have gone out and pulled other statues down now on the back of what's happened, even though they've got no agreement to take them down. Now, that is provocative. Because, you know, some would say, well you've got no basis to do that.
If it's gone through some vote, that's okay, is it?
Well, the question is, should we have democratic decisions or should mob
is
rule...
Is America a democracy?
No, it's not entirely a democracy, but having people charging around just deciding they don't like the statue, is that good enough as well? Perhaps not, you know. Perhaps somebody should pull down the statue of Lincoln. I don't think they should, but some people might think that they ought to because he was a bad guy in various ways in their view. The IRA blew up Nelson's column in Dublin in 1966. There was a famous song about it. Down came Nelson, and because they were sick of having Nelson's column in the centre of Dublin.
Maybe we'll put a link to that on our show page. That song, but anyway. But Martin, Nancy Pelosi has called for the removal of Confederate statues from the Capitol building, which does seem a bit inflammatory because that is actually nothing to do with the federal government. It's the individual states that choose. They each have something like two or three statues they're allowed to put there.
Well, I mean, what's happened is that these statues have been made a political issue both by the left and by the right. The right wants to defend the right for them to be there. The left are getting geared up to say they shouldn't be there. And what will probably happen is some will be removed and some won't, and various rows will be had about it. But I think the issue whether statues should or shouldn't be there is a legitimate debate, and we've got to find out what people think about
it. It's a little bit about the control of history, isn't it?
Of course it is. But, I mean, there's no point moaning about that. I mean, you could argue that all statues that are in place should never be removed, like Rhodes' statue on Rhodes House in Oxford. But you might want to put a blue plaque next to it saying, well, in actual fact, modern Oxford University doesn't agree with his imperialist views, but we're not going to remove the statue just for the hell of it. That's one solution. Or you might decide, no, that statue's got to go. But I think that's a kind of, that's a legitimate debate. And it's no use people saying, well, the statues, all statues that are already there have got to stay. I mean, as you say, there is no statue of Thomas Clarkson, who the great hero of abolition in Bristol. Why not? Maybe there should be.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
Well, off to Barcelona then, Martin. Some pretty horrific events there yesterday. Again, it's a van, hired van, it looks like, driven into a crowd. Apparently the object, in one of the statements released, is saying that this is an attempt to create a Spanish caliphate.
Well, I, you know,
the Muslims did control a large part.
Well, they did. They used to, but it was more in Andalusia in the south. And Barcelona, of course, is the capital of Catalonia, which is about to have a referendum on seceding from Spain.
Finally,
so it may be. I mean, we know that the NATO intelligence services have been orchestrating terrorist attacks for 30 or 40 years. We don't know yet. We don't know enough about it to say maybe it is what it looks like, just somebody driving a truck. But if you know, if you remember what happened in Nice, when the truck was driven, the police had taken away the barriers which would have stopped the truck. Then the truck arrived, crashed into everybody. All the guy driving it was a not known to be a Muslim, but known to be a Muslim, but not known to be at all devout. In fact, he's got a big track record as a petty criminal. And then the CCTV footage was banned from the secret services, wanted it all wiped.
Also, the FBI had been following him for months, hadn't they, very closely. Whatever the FBI were doing in France, I'm not quite sure.
Well, that's right. Now, we know, Operation Gladio, going back to the 70s, that the NATO intelligence services do and have orchestrated terrorist attacks.
FBI?
Yes. We've got evidence that 95% of people convicted of terrorist offences in the US since 9/11 have been set up by the FBI. In other words, there would have been no plot if they hadn't set it up.
Well, let's go through some of this. Vans. Actually, vans, modern vans, just like modern cars, many of them can actually be controlled from outside, can't they? You can have someone hacking in and influencing someone to steer in a particular direction.
Yep.
Apparently, the van driver has been killed now, so, of course, they won't be able to interrogate him or have a court case about him. This is another aspect of these that really bothers me, is this whole shoot-to-kill policy of the police. So they're actually making sure that there's no trial.
Well, indeed, and in the attack in Berlin, if you remember, in the Christmas market, the guy was definitely an informant for the intelligence services and had been watched for months. Now, in other words, it's possible that people are... The intelligence service is either making these things happen on purpose or letting things happen on purpose, either MIHOP, as they call it, or LIHOP. Now, that doesn't mean that it may be that this is not one of those attacks that's been orchestrated and it really is genuine attackers, etc. But the Madrid train bombings back in 2003, there was all sorts of suspicions about that. And, of course, all of the people ended up dead, so there was never any trial. And, we're suspicious about all of these incidents and suspicious that the state has got some hand in them.
One unnamed eyewitness told the BBC's Frank Gardiner that one of the dying attackers was smiling as he was shot.
Well, I mean, these people are either fanatics or patsies or brainwashed. And... we just don't know what the truth is.
Well, that's one of the things I'm suggesting. Mm-hmm. That could just be a lie. It's very easy to go up to Frank Gardiner, who is very, very close with all the security services. In fact, accused by Charles Shoebridge of effectively being a press officer for MI5 or MI6. And we know, don't we, during the John Charles de Menezes case, for example, that we were told that Charles de Menezes had vaulted over the 7/7, just after the 7/7 attacks, and vaulted over the barriers at Stockwell Tube Station, where actually it turned out that the guy that had spoken to the press was a plainclothes police officer that had told the press this, when it was just simply not the case. It was a lie. So it's quite feasible that these journalists have been played for fools.
Quite feasible, and we've got to understand the pattern here. We know that Islamist jihadis have been working closely with the intelligence services in the West for decades. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, of which the Manchester bomber was a member and his father was a member, have been working with MI6 and were being trained by SAS to fight Gaddafi less than 3 years ago.
People in northern Spain have been asked to post pictures of cats instead of images of these attacks. Now, that may be perfectly legitimate to post a picture of a cat instead of an image of the attack. But, of course, this is also because social media is quite powerful in spreading evidence that can then be questioned by journalists like you and I and other people around the world that the official story is not actually what we're being told. So the idea of encouraging people not to tweet any or post or email or share on social media pictures of anything to do with the attacks makes it impossible, really, for people to put up a potential alternative version of events.
Well, that's right. And I'm afraid that over the decades, that NATO's involvement in this kind of provocation has been proved many times. Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book that came out in 2012, which basically accused NATO intelligence services of being behind all the terrorism in Italy, right and left, in the 1970s and 1980s.
There's been a proposal today from several people. I noticed some news stories about it too, about the idea of profiling Arab North Africans who hire vans.
Well, what may turn out to be the case is that these people have been watched by the intelligence service for ages, like the guy who carried out the Berlin attack.
I mean, what they're saying is that anybody that hires a van that is of Arab North African descent, maybe there should be special checks made into them.
Well, ultimately, but the purpose of these attacks, if they are being orchestrated from inside the structure, is the step-by-step creation of a police state.
But, I mean, that is also, it's a very sneaky way, really, of saying that these people are somehow dangerous terrorists. If you're Arab North African, you're much more likely to be a terrorist, whereas, of course, we know that there are all sorts of other types of terrorists out there, and some of them hide under the cloak of the state and the so-called legitimate militaries.
Well, that's right. I mean, we simply don't have enough information to make firm judgments about this attack at this moment.
What about this principle of profiling people before they hire a van?
I think we need to have independent police investigation of every incident, and that one of the things that the police need to bear in mind is the involvement of the security services in terrorism. Because they've been involved in terrorism for decades.
I mean, you know, wouldn't they just get one of their mates who wasn't North African Arab descent to hire the van for them?
Well, yes, if they were genuine terrorists and they're not just set up patsies who are being made to create a kind of enemy within that we're all supposed to be terrified of.
One thing I haven't heard talked about at all as a motive is that it might be related to the hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and now Syria and Yemen too.
Well, there is a mainstream discourse about that. If you remember Jeremy Corbyn, for example, after the Manchester attacks, said, you know, we've got to accept, and 60-70% of public opinion in Britain also accepted.
I've not heard that related to this attack. It just seems to me.
Well, that's because Spain withdrew from Iraq as soon as after the Madrid bombs, Zapatero won the election because most people blamed Aznar's participation in the Iraq war for the attack. Now, Spain has actually withdrawn from Iraq, so I would suspect if we're looking for a motive here, the popular party government in Madrid is very, very unhappy about this upcoming referendum in Barcelona, which could lead to Catalan independence, which could also create a run on the Spanish banking system, etc. So something like this, which can, you know, they can call a state of emergency. They're already saying that the referendum's illegal. So they could say the national government could call a state of emergency on the back of this, which would make the referendum undoable.
But, I mean, in these other countries, Martin, whether it's Spain or not, because Spain, of course, is in NATO, the civilian deaths in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, some say Muslim civilians have been the target there.
Well, the point is that many, many people have been killed all over the world. I mean, this stuff goes on day in, day out in Baghdad, and has been going on every day since we invaded in 2003. It's been going on so much that we hardly bother to mention it. But that's what's been going on. And, you know, suddenly when it happens to people that we know, people who've got credit cards, people who go shopping, you know, real people, then we get upset. And, of course, it's morally indefensible. Killing innocent people is morally indefensible, whoever's doing it. Let's be clear. I mean, there's no way that there's moral equivalence between doing... I mean, that doesn't solve any problems by doing this. And a lot of these attacks are random, you know, they're directed at the general population. Vincenzo Vincinguerra, who's a fascist terrorist on the payroll of NATO, who carried out the various bombings and assassinations in Italy in the 70s, said that the whole point was to attack people in general, because they were, then they demand that the state does something to protect them. So these deliberate targeting of civilians is part of a Gladio-style strategy. That's what it looks like.
BBC.
My presumption is that this is NATO, but we haven't got enough evidence yet.
The BBC on Wednesday, the day before the attack, reported the following. On the streets of Europe, we meet teenage boys trained by Islamic State. Their testimony reveals wide-ranging plans to turn children into killers. It starts off, Mutasim is nervous. The 16-year-old has never flown in a plane before. He's looking around at other passengers waiting at departure gate at Athens Airport. He's unsure of himself. As the flight is called, the Syrian boy runs through the few phrases of Spanish he's learned. The authorities may ask him questions, and he's travelling on a fake Spanish passport. It costs more than €3,000. I mean, it's interesting that Spain is mentioned in this article just the day before as a place where these child Syrian terrorists may be heading.
And that may be a clue that we're being fed a line already about what's supposed to have happened here.
It's called predictive programming, isn't it?
Yeah. And don't forget, the Syrian general staff, the Iranian general staff, the Russian general staff, and the Iraqi general staff, which answers to the democratically elected government of Iraq, are all firmly of the opinion that ISIS has been armed, trained, and directed by NATO. And we know that that from Jordan and Turkey, ISIS has been receiving money and arms and also exporting oil, which has then been used. Bilal Erdogan, the son of President Erdogan, was accused of personally profiting from all of this. This is all out there. I mean, in the Middle East, people think that ISIS equals NATO. But, of course, in Middle England, people don't follow the news. They're too busy watching EastEnders and football.
In the coverage of this attack since yesterday, which has been pretty much wall-to-wall on the world news channels, the BBC and the radio, etc.,
yeah.
Interviews with the eyewitnesses haven't really informed us. There's been very little deeper analysis as to the context, and that seems to be, to me, what's missing. Yes, you know, it's an attack. There's a van driving at people. There's a whole wave of innocent civilians having to run out of the way of the van, but that doesn't really teach you anything about what the context of the event is.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't teach you anything about the context of the particular event. And, of course, what we do on this show is remind people of the history of the state's manipulation of these events to create... I mean, the bombing of Bologna Railway Station in 1980 killed 86 people. Nearly 10 times as many as we've just killed yesterday in Barcelona. But that was definitely NATO. And you know what? Nobody's ever been sent to prison for any of it. And therefore the same people, possibly the very same people, are behind what's going on here and what went on there. But we don't know this. We must be careful to be sure that we don't overstep our own evidence.
Okay, if there is a real problem with Syrian terrorists and Islamist terrorists infiltrating Britain, infiltrating all over Europe, surely the best thing to do is just round up all the Muslims and put them in concentration camps and be done with it.
Well, that is one of the things that's being suggested by the radical right. And, of course, then the purpose of these attacks, whether if they are part of a Gladio-style strategy, is to terrify the population so that the state can then take whatever steps it wants to take to control the population and move on to, you know, what we're going to do next and what we're going to do after that. Don't forget what happened after the Madrid train bombings was that a large number of younger people and poorer people came out to vote in the election who weren't going to vote anyway, and Zapatero, the socialist candidate, won instead of Aznar, and he immediately withdrew from Iraq. Now, in other words, the Spanish state has been a rather lukewarm participant in the war on terror, so they need to be reminded what terror is so that they can be chivied back into line. That's that's the sort of qui bono question that you need to ask. What's this really about?
What about terrorists taking away our freedoms? That's what apparently is the motive here.
Well, what's going on here is, if it is what we think it is, the state orchestrates these attacks at second hand, like the Kouachi brothers who left their passports in their getaway car and then got murdered after Charlie Hebdo. All of the evidence points to the state's involvement in those attacks. It takes a while to analyse what's happened. But if the pattern is as in the past, all of these attacks are being orchestrated from inside the structure. And people should be afraid, be very afraid, because it isn't just random nutters. We've actually got a security structure which is paid for by our taxes, which doesn't even, not even there to prevent these attacks, it's actually there to foment these attacks. And what we really need to see is independent police investigation of what's happened here. And that would include the local police in Barcelona.
Yeah, and one thing the Barcelona police do seem to have done is to stop a much bigger attack. It looked as if that they were originally planning a huge vehicle bomb.
And yes, but all the people Spanish there have been shot dead. So that's a question that does raise questions. So there's never going to be any interrogation.
Although
of those
one
people.
Arrested man says his brother stole his ID to rent the van. That's Musa Ukabir, who's still being hunted.
Now,
by
what people have got to get
by now have been shot.
What people have got to get their heads round is that those who are participating in the attacks, some of them are genuine terrorists who genuinely have grievances in their own mind. But that doesn't mean that the state isn't manipulating what's going on, because the state in the past has done exactly that.
ISIS has also claimed responsibility for this attack.
Yes, well, but is it through Rita Katz's website? Site, for example, is that where what's that? How do we know? I mean, when P. O'Neill claimed responsibility for IRA attacks, you knew it was the IRA because they were the only people who used that pseudonym. When ISIS claims things, who the hell are ISIS? How do we know who's claimed what attacks? ISIS is almost a kind of completely confected phenomenon. And as I said to you earlier, I'll just repeat, the Syrian general staff, the Russian general staff, the Iranian general staff, the Iraqi general staff, don't forget they're our allies, they all think that ISIS is run by NATO. All of them.
A message from the news agency AMAC, we've got links actually on off of our show page at thisweek.org.uk. ISIS themselves have denied denied stories that have been published by AMAC. So there's certainly some doubts about AMAQ news agency. A message said the perpetrators of the attack in Barcelona are Islamic State soldiers and carried out the operation on command of Khalifa of targeting coalition countries. The coalition refers to the US-led force fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria.
Okay, so somebody claims that they've claimed the
director of Site Intelligence Group said the AMAC claim was preceded by celebration from the ISIS community.
Well, Rita Katz is a former Mossad intelligence agent based round the corner from the CIA in Langley, Virginia. And she seems to have inside knowledge of everything ISIS is going to do. Strange that, eh?
Okay, Martin, also, the minute.
Let's put a link to her website, by all means. Let's people see who she is.
I will do that at thisweek.org.uk. Also, it does make me wonder, I mean, looking at this sort of... the way that this has just not really been explained at all properly in the mainstream press about the context of this. We haven't even mentioned Operation Gladio, the strategy of tension in the 1980s.
Well, I have pretty much mentioned
it. Well, yeah, but to explain what it was about, it was really about bouncing populations and politicians and journalists into believing that there was an external threat, where actually it was fascist cells, internal fascist cells, carrying out terrorist attacks.
That's right, and people have got to understand the history. And also, of course, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, was on television in France 3 years ago now, and he said he was approached by British officials, said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? So, in other words, the armed groups in Syria have intimate links with Western intelligence services. Now, these people are supposedly ISIS, supposedly linked to the people fighting in Syria and Iraq. Well, those people have links with Western intelligence services. As I said earlier, I've listed the armed forces in the world who believe that NATO and ISIS are linked phenomenon. Now, that's not because they're not stupid. They've got a war to fight. They can't afford to make mistakes. That's what they think. And Rita Katz, I said Rita Katz would probably be the source of all of this, and it turns out, yes, she is. She is a shill. She's a shill for the Israelis.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, she's basically... What she does is she comes out and tells the journalists all over the world, oh yes, ISIS did this, ISIS did that, I know everything about ISIS. And she knows more about ISIS than ISIS knows about ISIS. Very strange that, isn't it, considering she's an Israeli intelligence officer. How does she know so much?
Ex ex?
Well, supposedly an ex-intelligence officer, but still very prominent. And this Amak site, as you pointed out, various people from ISIS said it's nothing to do with us. So you can see this is a hall of mirrors. But people have got to understand the basic truth of the matter is, and it goes back decades, NATO has been involved in all kinds of terrorism, including Islamist terrorism. From the 1980s onward, Operation Cyclone set up Al-Qaeda. As Robin Cook said when he was Foreign Secretary, Al-Qaeda simply means the base, the database, and that database was held in Amman in Jordan by NATO-aligned intelligence officers, and it was a list of all the people that were armed, trained, and sent to Afghanistan to topple the regime there. And then they all came back to the Middle East, and some of them came back to Western Europe. But the linkages between these groups and Western intelligence services goes back 30 or 40 years. So people say, well, it can't be true. They're just made crazy. They're just out to get us. Just look at the history. Look, that's the real context of all of these attacks.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
The Hong Kong activist Joshua Wong has been jailed for 6 months. This is for taking part in the 2014 pro-democracy protest. He was tried and found guilty of unlawful assembly and sentenced to community service. But in an unusual move, the Hong Kong government appealed the sentence, arguing it was too lenient. The sentence means he cannot stand for any more local elections for another 5 years. And he was elected to Hong Kong's legislature last year, but was disqualified last month when the city's High Court ruled that he had improperly taken his oath. So they told him that he couldn't be an MP, and now they've jailed him for 6 months.
Well, it's an ongoing struggle all over the world to create...
What about China, though, particularly?
Well,
Hong Kong. I mean, you know, I think there was a real problem, isn't there, handing over to the Chinese when effectively what you're dealing with is a system which doesn't really allow demonstrations, doesn't like...
Well, that's right, and they weren't allowed before either. What the Chinese argue is you can't change the regulations inside Hong Kong when we take over, because the British never allowed any democracy in Hong Kong. Of course they didn't allow it. And when the Chinese took over, they said that the deal was that they would take it over with the existing setup intact. Now, of course, some people in Hong Kong aren't very happy about that. They weren't happy about it before the British left, and they're not happy about it now.
Well, what's the point of having a parliament if when one of those parliamentarians goes out on a demonstration that they can be arrested and jailed?
Well, you may well argue whether there's... I mean, don't forget that the Chinese Communist Party leadership take the view that, you know, that they're in charge and they can decide what the policy is, and that's international law backs them up.
I mean,
in that
seems
and so
to be
on.
Some big changes going on in Hong Kong at the moment, real serious, like, clampdown by the Chinese, because there's a political activist, Howard Lam. He is saying that the Chinese agents drove staples into his legs over a message to the footballer Lionel Messi. A bizarre episode heightens the concerns about the erosion of the rule of law in the city. The Chinese are denying it, but he's clearly had someone has driven staples into his legs, and they have been arresting him and taking away from his home and trying to disappear this guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'm not trying to justify any of that. I would point out, though, that what the Chinese would say, the Chinese government would say, is that these people do not represent majority opinion inside Hong Kong, and that most people in Hong Kong don't have a very big interest in politics. They're there to make money, and these people are being put up to it by Western powers, etc., etc. That's their narrative. Of course, people are going to resist that, and, you know, all over the world, this is an ongoing
asking
round.
Asking for a signed photograph of this Argentine soccer star Messi, and you're abducted and have staples put in your legs.
Well, so he claims, and he claims that the Chinese government did it. They say they didn't. So, you know, we've got
under house arrest after her husband.
Yes, sir. Well, okay, well, it's possible that the Chinese...
manifesto known as Charter 8 was awarded the Nobel Prize in 2010. She's remained under strict control of the Chinese authorities since her husband's death. So, I mean, you know, you've got a clear government clampdown on anybody that really wants democracy, whether or not they're actually doing any kind of street protests. It's really a kind of thought police.
It is, but of course, in Saudi Arabia, they've been carrying out the complete demolition of a Shia town in which hundreds of people have been killed.
But China apparently are our great trading partners, aren't they?
Well, Saudi Arabia. So are Saudi Arabia. But we're hearing about these people who've been sent to prison for 6 months. protests in Hong Kong and not the hundreds of people who've been killed by the Saudi military in the last 2 weeks in the eastern provinces of Saudi Arabia. Because, of course, we really are friends with the Saudi Arabians. That's why Theresa May made her first foreign visit there once she became Prime Minister. But also, are we going to go to war with them?
Also,
perhaps we should.
Hong Kong is now going to replace the 24-hour BBC World Service broadcast on the radio in Hong Kong with Chinese state programming, which I can tell you is like watching paint dry. I mean, the BBC World Service is better than what you get on Radio 4, for example, but the Chinese government is saying this is a move to enhance cultural exchange between the mainland and city-state. Anyone that's ever watched CCTV, the Chinese International English language television service, I mean, it really is appalling. Just so dull, and there's just no kind of soul or imagination in it whatsoever, certainly no humour. And the Russians and the BBC actually show them up, but they're now saying that Hong Kong can't listen to the BBC anymore.
Well, what I might suggest to you, Tony, is that what's actually happening all over the world is we're preparing for World War III. And therefore, all of these steps being taken by the Chinese, the Russians, the Saudis, everybody, I mean, we're preparing for a big fight. Saudi Arabia is a real rogue state. They've invaded Bahrain, and we're about to build a naval base there, even though the locals don't want us. And they've invaded Yemen. China, Iran. Hong Kong...
I mean, we haven't mentioned Iran, have we? Because there's some fascinating news out of there this week. They are now saying that they will quit the nuclear deal in hours if the US tries to impose any new sanctions. Iran's President Rouhani said his country could quit its deal curbing nuclear work within hours if the US imposes any new sanctions. This hasn't got a lot of reporting over here, but it's a major move.
It is, and of course what's happening is the two sides for World War III are being lined up. And everybody's battening down the hatches, and that's the context in which all of these things we've been talking about are taking place.
Well, let's have a listen now to Jim Mars, who sadly died just a couple of weeks ago. Last week it was, and he was a 9/11 scholar. He's described as, and here he is just talking about some of his views on the September 11th attacks, which of course kicked off the good old war on terrorism, which has now brought us to this point where Martin's just pointing out it could be a third world war getting ready to kick off.
Well, I have studied many conspiracy theories in my life, and the absolute worst one I've ever heard is the official version of 9/11. We were told that 19 Muslim fanatics somehow bypassed our $40 billion defense system, hijacked four planes simultaneously, causing their transponders to go off almost at the exact same time. We're totally lost from FAA radar, not to mention satellite radar and NORAD radar, made their way to New York and crashed into two prominent landmarks, the two towers of the World Trade Center, and then another one crashed into the Pentagon, and then another one crashed in Pennsylvania. And all of this under the direction of a Muslim cleric hiding in a cave in Afghanistan with a computer. Now, if that isn't about the craziest conspiracy theory I ever heard, and yet that is what we are expected to accept as the legitimate version of what happened on 9/11. But as anyone who studied the facts knows, there's too many gaps in that whole story. The evidence points to something much larger than that. First, we start with war game exercises. Vigilant warrior, vigilant guardian. For more than a year, no one even knew that these war game exercises were being conducted on the morning of 9/11. And when it began to circulate on the internet, the response seemed to be, this is some sort of internet hoax. And yet, when Richard Clark, who was then the counterterrorism chief, published his book, he, within six pages, talked about the war games exercises. He contacted General Myers of NORAD and said, we have planes hijacked. Do you have interceptors in the air? And the first thing Myers said was, well, is this real or is this the war games? The FAA had as many as 22 images on their radar screens that were false software images simulating hijacked planes. Our normal interceptors had training ammunition and were off into Canada, off over the Atlantic, here, there, and everywhere. and it was because of these war game exercises that the hijackers were able to penetrate our normal defense system and cause the havoc that they did on 9/11. And yet there's been very little or no mention of this. Why? Because the National Security Agency intercepted a message from Mohammed Atta, who we are told was the leader of the hijacks, the day before, in which he said, "The match is about to begin. Tomorrow is 0 hour." Notice he didn't say the jihad or the operation or the attack. He said the match. The games begin tomorrow, and that's 0 hour. Now, if the public in the United States had no idea of these war games, how did the hijackers know to coordinate their attacks with these war game exercises? And there's only one explanation. This was an inside job. They had inside information. And then it just goes on and on from there. The collapse of the World Trade Center was one of the biggest disasters in world history. More firemen were killed than in any other one event. This was the first and only instances of modern skyscrapers that just completely collapsed upon themselves. It was the largest structural failure in history. And yet, where was the investigation? They should have had everyone from building contractors and structural engineers and metallurgists and everything else. They should have pored over that evidence for months and months and even years to find out what really happened, to make sure it would never happen again. But this didn't happen. In fact, who investigated it? Was it the New York Fire Department or the New York Police Department? No. Was it the FBI? No. It was FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, which answers directly to the President of the United States. What did they do? They employed 26 engineers and then would not even let them look at all the evidence or look at all the buildings involved. And they had to give out a pretty tepid report. Then they took the steel, which should have been studied from hell to breakfast to find out how that could have collapsed, even under intense fires, and it was all shipped overseas. Blatant destruction of evidence. But the key of the World Trade Center lies not in the Twin Towers. What you have to look at is Building 7. Building 7 was nestled between the Verizon Building, the U.S. Post Office, across the street from the World Trade Center complex. This was a 47-story steel and concrete structure, and at about 5:20 on the afternoon of September the 11th, no planes hit this building, but it caved in on itself and totally collapsed into its own footprint, so perfectly that it did very little damage to the Verizon Building or the U.S. Post Office. Larry Silverstein, the leasor of the World Trade Center, said on public television that he didn't want any more loss of life. He was afraid that there could be a problem. So he told them to pull it, and he stood there while they pulled it. Pulling it is an industry jargon for a controlled demolition, and that's exactly what happened to Building 7. The commander of the New York Fire Department, in talking about Buildings 5 and 6 that were so heavily damaged, said we had to pull them, and they blew down those buildings too. Well, if Building 7 was the result of a controlled demolition, then I think that there's every reason in the world to ask the question, was the towers the result of controlled demolition? The thing that really concerns me, having covered many controlled building demolitions, is that when they blow a building down, there is still huge chunks of concrete everywhere, and they have to go in and break all that up. In the World Trade Center, it was pulverized, nothing but dust and debris everywhere. Something with tremendous pressure was able to pulverize the concrete in those buildings. And I would point you simply to the Windsor Hotel in Madrid, Spain, which in early 2005 burned out of control through a whole weekend for 3 or 4 days, completely gutted the building, had temperatures in excess of 1,000 degrees. Building never collapsed. So there are serious questions that were never addressed by the handpicked 9/11 Commission. Witnesses have been silenced. The people that I would particularly point to are the maintenance engineers for the North and South Tower, who are on the public record saying that there were multiple explosions in the buildings and explosions underground. Mike Pecoraro was in a sixth-floor sub-basement when the building shook. He and a worker went to the third sub-basement, which was a machine shop, and he said it was destroyed. He said, I'm talking about a 50-ton drill press just gone. What caused the destruction in the basements of the World Trade Center before those buildings collapsed? Nobody's addressed that question. And, of course, there's so many questions about the Pentagon that we are told that a big Boeing 757 smacked into the Pentagon, folded up like a tube, and just roared in there and then caught fire and burned up with such intensity that there's no wreckage left. We all know that after every major air disaster, they reconstruct the aircraft. They take every little piece they can find and they go to a hangar and they reassemble it so they can figure out what happened to that aircraft. Show me a picture of the 757 pieced back together from the Pentagon, and I'll shut up about the questions about the Pentagon, but they haven't showed us that, and they won't. There's too many unanswered questions. This is a tremendous cover-up that's taken place. If we are going to continue to call ourselves a free people, we better start demanding some truthful answers.
That's the voice of Jim Mars there, who died last week. He's the author of many books. One of them I read many years ago is Rule by Secrecy, excellent book. And on 9/11 specifically, Martin, he wrote Inside Job, Unmasking the 9/11 Conspiracies. And more recently, which is a broader book, is The Terror Conspiracy, Deception, 9/11 and the Loss of Liberty.
Yeah, well, I think if we're thinking about what happened in Barcelona yesterday, you've got to put it in the context of all of the evidence that suggests that the 9/11 attacks were some kind of inside job. And, of course, the official death toll of 9/11 is about 3,500. Probably a lot more people died because there were undocumented workers in those buildings. If that can happen, then it's quite possible that the intelligence services are orchestrating minor attacks like the one we saw in Barcelona. And it's about time people woke up to what's going on. It's far more dangerous than just random people carrying out random attacks. We've actually got an orchestrated infrastructure embedded within the state structures of the Western world. And you say, well, what can we do about this? Well, I say, we've got to get independent police investigations. And those police officers have got to take into account the possibility and probability in many cases that the state intelligence services are involved.
I mean, you're talking about a kind of tyranny.
Yes, that's exactly what we're talking about. 9/11 was a turning point, as Tony Blair always tells us. And it was a turning point where we started to march ever faster towards a police state. But of course, the Gladio structures were in place since the end of World War II.
Almost seems also like manipulation and control of mass populations is a kind of religion almost, a study certainly, if not a religion, a belief system.
Well, it's what they call stratcom and psychological warfare. There's thousands of people paid massive amounts of money to involve themselves in psychological warfare on behalf of the state, and what's involved in that is basically manipulating people's perceptions.
And often the mainstream press is pliable.
That's right, because they're generally owned by the corporations who are the ultimate, probably. I mean, you know, if you think about it, this
is Haven Corporation.
Yes, that's right. What we've got is a criminal oligarchy which uses terrorism as a means to control the population.
Well, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Brislington West, Joss Clark. Also to, you just heard there, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialects on next Tuesday at noon. It's online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This show's links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1997 and The Verve. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
gonna change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, and those coming down the road for us and for our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I hope that that has prepared me for presenting these economic insights to you. As usual, we start with a very few brief announcements. For those of you who have kindly offered to be supportive of what we do, I want to urge you, the simplest way to do that is to go to patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, and there you can see this program as a TV program and express whatever support you have in mind. I also want to thank you for making use of our websites. We maintain them 24/7, no charge whatsoever, and they allow you to communicate with us what you like and don't about this program, to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and in general to make use of the materials we upload literally every day to help us reach even more people through your partnership, which is a goal of this program. And finally, I want to remind everyone that we now have an arrangement with a speakers bureau. It's called speakoutnow.org, located in Oakland, California. If you're interested in having me come to speak to an organization in your area, which I would enjoy doing, please get in touch with them. The easiest way to do that is to email them at info@speakoutnow.org. Let's then jump into our updates for today. Recently, the Christian Science Monitor did an interesting report that came to me as a reminder of what a recovery in economics should be but isn't. And I'm talking about the recovery in quotation marks today. Millennials. That famous group that we're all talking about now, young people basically, have been studied, and in the way that the Christian Science Monitor did it, have been studied in terms of how their economic fortunes compare with that of their parents when the parents were the same age as the millennials are today. And the result, I found extraordinary. First, millennials today are getting 20% less income than their parents got at the same age, adjusting for the prices. In other words, the children are 20% less well off financially than are the parents, or rather than the parents were at the same age. It's interesting that millennials not only earn less than the so-called baby boomers, but they are hampered by much higher rates of student debt, and they are much less likely than their parents to own their own homes. As the Christian Science Monitor points out, the notion that hard work and studying will get you ahead of where your parents were, that's not true anymore. They're working harder, they're studying longer, but between the debts they have to incur to study longer, they're not earning anywhere near what their parents earned. And since the pensions that their parents were able to get, which guaranteed them a certain amount of income after they reached 65, the current group of millennials either have no pension at all or have what's called a 401k plan, which depends on how much money you put in and how well it does in the stock market, which means at the very least that your future is more precarious as well as more poorly paid than that of your parents. The notion of the upward and onward quality of life in America is being destroyed person by person, month by month, and this study in the Christian Science Monitor documents it. The lesson here is that an economic system like ours has not built into it every generation does better than the one before. That was true for much of American history until the 1970s. It's over. It's not coming back. And the direction is the opposite. Let me turn now to a perennial, but one that cannot be overly discussed. The health care crisis. And I'm an economist, so we're going to look at it from an economic point of view. You can imagine that if one is interested in health care and how it's financed, that I would have had my attention really riveted when I picked up the Bloomberg News on August 2nd, 2017, and read the following headline. I'll read it to you now. Americans die younger despite spending the most on health care. That's what the headline in the Bloomberg News Service, that service that is used by virtually every financial institution in the United States, that's what they said. Article was by Lori Meisler, and I urge you to read it if you have the time to go check out the Bloomberg archive. Here's some of the basic findings that she had. The United States does poorly in terms of longevity. The OECD, which ranks the 30 or 40 most developed economic countries in the world, ranks the United States 27th when it comes to life expectancy. Keep in mind, we pay more for our health care than anywhere on earth, but 26 countries, all of whom spend less on their health care than we do, have people living longer. But that's the least of it. Listen to this. We have the fourth highest infant mortality rate of all the countries in the OECD. We have the sixth highest maternal mortality rate. And the ninth highest likelihood of dying at a younger age from a host of ailments, including cardiovascular disease and cancer. In one ranking, we are at the top of the list. Here's what it is. We are the most obese country in the OECD. We lead in drug-related death, and we rank 33rd in the prevalence of diabetes. And here comes something the article really stunned me with. 88% of Americans say they are in good or very good health. By contrast, the Japanese, who have the highest life expectancy in the OECD, only 35% of the Japanese think they are in good health. It is a wonderful testimony to what you can make people believe and how different it can be from what they actually experience. Well, when the Bloomberg survey in this article asks the obvious question, with these poor or mediocre results in terms of the quality of our health, why are we paying way more than anybody else on this planet? They mentioned in this article, as one big reason, the cost of drugs and of medicines, which are higher in this country than in all the other OECD countries. And the question is, well, why? How is that possible? How can drug companies get away with charging more here than the same country does for the same medicine elsewhere? Sometimes just across the border in Canada to our north or in Mexico to our south. And there my attention was caught by a recent article in the New York Times, which pointed out very cleverly that there's a whole problem in the United States of drug companies requiring doctors, hospitals, and drug distributors to push onto the clients, you and me, brand name drugs, even after what are called generics. When a brand name drug's patent runs out, then other companies can produce the same drug much, much more cheaply. And they do. Those are called generics. They're the exact chemical equivalent of whatever the brand name was. They don't carry the brand name, and they sell for the cost of production, which is typically a small fraction of what the brand name drug sells for. Well, it turns out the drug companies cut deals with the doctors and the hospitals and the drug distributors to push the brand name on the client, to force it in some cases, to just urge it, to give kickbacks. One of the companies named was CVS Caremark as a distributor who has deals with the drug makers to try to push brand name drugs. Well, I'd like to summarize the message here. Medical care in our country is a monopoly operated by four industries that work together. Hospitals, doctors, the insurance companies, medical insurance companies, and finally, the drug and device makers. Those four help each other, like we just illustrated with a drug company working in cahoots with an insurance company to get the insurance company or the doctor or the hospital to push the brand name drugs. And you can be sure that the drug companies do good things for them in return. Together, they make the cost of medical care higher in the United States, even though the quality of the medical care we get is mediocre or poor. And in any case, much poorer than that in many countries which do not allow such a monopoly to function. The next economic update takes me back to a topic I have addressed before. This has to do with the automobile companies, and in particular the German automobile companies. Now, they have been caught and have admitted to fouling the air by deliberately installing in their diesel cars devices that fake the emissions during the emissions test so that you could get on the road millions of their cars that are polluting the air because they have fooled the emissions control that is trying to be made. This has so enraged people around the world at being systematically damaged by this fraudulent, profit-driven behavior of the big automobile companies in Germany. Above all, Volkswagen, but the others are caught in it too, Mercedes-Benz and others. It has led a number of places in the world to say they don't trust these companies anymore. They don't want to have anything to do with diesel, since that's where this was done. So you have, across Europe, cities that are banning all diesel vehicles. Athens in Greece has done that. Madrid in Spain has done that. And that is pushing a development which the German car companies, and you have to give them some respect for the sheer audacity here, they are pushing against that. They are lobbying and spending money and effort to prevent cities from banning the diesel. Second thing they're doing, which I find amazing and, again, audacious, is they don't want to install devices on all the old diesel cars, which would stop them from doing the pollution that they've gotten away with. But instead, they want to give rebates for people to trade in the old diesel for a new one. That's asking the world to trust them after the reasonableness of trusting them has been proven by them to not exist. What is going on here? What are the lessons in this ongoing horrible story out of the German automobile industry? Number one, they put profit above human health. There's no nice way to say it, and why should one bother? It's important to look this truth in the face. They made a decision that was good for their company's profits. The fact that it polluted the air for millions of people, Germans included, wasn't enough to prevent them from doing it. You have to stop and let that horrible truth sink in. Number two, the German government is in a very cozy relationship with the car companies. It's the largest industry in the country, so it isn't very surprising. There was a recent case where a leading Social Democratic Party official, the Social Democratic Party is often in a coalition government with Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party. He was caught having given a speech he gave on the floor of Parliament to VW to look at before he gave it, as if VW has the final word on what is said by a leading politician. That's called a cozy relationship in which the business helps the politician and vice versa. But the point is not that they're doing that, that's bad enough, but that they're doing it at the expense of the people they sell the cars to and the people who they're supposed to represent as their elected leaders. And yet, there's a good point here, too, and a good lesson. Massive anger of the mass of people, that's what is stopping this. The people were able to get the politicians in Athens and Madrid to ban those diesel automobiles. They were able to hit back. They were able to teach a lesson to these companies that you can get caught. You will pay a heavy price. Your whole business of diesel automobiles looks to be over in the world. They're not going to trust you anymore. You took a chance in behaving in the way your profits dictated. Maybe you oughtn't to. And maybe for us the lesson is, why do we allow profits to be the driver of what companies do? Maybe we ought to have companies run by a kind of mixed board, people who work in the company and the people they're supposed to serve, the customer, together having their representatives on the board. So nothing happens that privileges one of them at the expense of the other because they're both in on the key decisions together. Well, that's the idea behind a co-op, especially a co-op that includes not only the workers in the plants, in the factories, but the people who live around them, who live with the consequences of what they do, the customers who live with the consequences of the product they produce. Let the people who have a stake in what these companies do run them, the stakeholders, all of them, not a tiny group who can profit at the expense of everybody else. The last economic update we will have time for today is also one with rich lessons for us. The story is about something that happened recently in Little Rock, Arkansas. A city I don't talk about that often, but here it's a very important story. In the late 1990s, as happened in so many parts of the United States, eastern Arkansas saw the disappearance of thousands and thousands of jobs, as manufacturing of textiles and other things basically shut down and the jobs were moved overseas, where workers could be paid much, much less than those workers were paid then. It plunged Little Rock, the whole state of Arkansas, but particularly eastern Arkansas, into a depression that has lasted the last 20 years, made worse by the collapse in 2008, but from which no recovery has been possible. Thus it was with great fanfare that the governor of Arkansas announced in Little Rock the wonderful news that the Tianyuan, I apologize for my Chinese pronunciation, the Tianyuan Garments Company of Suzhou signed an agreement recently to buy an old factory in Little Rock, to refit it with new technology so that it would become a fully automated T-shirt production line, ultimately producing 800,000 T-shirts a day to be sold to the main customer of Tianyuan Garments Company, namely the Adidas Corporation, that I'm sure most of you know about. Proudly, the chairman of Tianyuan Garments announced that they will be producing one T-shirt every 22 seconds with this marvelous new machinery. And now I'm going to read you the announcement this chair of the company, the Chinese company, announced, the statement he made when he announced this with the governor. Quote, "Around the world, even the cheapest labor market can't compete with us. I am really excited about this," he said. Well, let me make sure everybody understands what this means, what the message here is. First, companies producing T-shirts and many other things were providing a living, a decent living, for many thousands of Arkansas residents. Then they left, moved to China, made a lot more money by paying workers there a lot less, enjoyed those profits for 20 years, while the families, the people, the economy, the neighborhoods, the cities of eastern Arkansas declined and suffered the decline of so many in America. Now, after 20 years, the governor is all excited about the return of a factory once again making T-shirts in eastern Arkansas. How many jobs will it produce? They hope within 4 years, 400 jobs. What will be the average pay? And when I tell you this, I hope you gasp the way I did when I read it. $14 an hour. That's what the people of Arkansas can look for. They lost thousands of jobs paying well, suffered 20 years, and are now supposed to be overjoyed the way their governor was when they're going to get, over 4 years, 400 jobs at $14 an hour. But the story isn't over. In order to get the company to settle in Little Rock, Arkansas gave them the following: $1.6 million a year for each of the next 5 years as a tax reduction. That means they won't have to pay the taxes they would otherwise have had to pay to the state of Arkansas so it can do things. But we're still not done. $1 million in a straight-out cash subsidy. $500,000 for worker retraining. You have to do a lot of retraining for a work that pays $14 an hour. They were also given, as part of this deal, by both Little Rock and the Pulaski County, of which Little Rock is a part, a cut of 65% in the property tax they would have had to pay. If you own land and a factory in Arkansas, you have to pay property tax to the city and the county where it's located. But 65% of that tax they won't have to pay. Now, friends, let's be clear. If you give them a subsidy, that's money the state of Arkansas or the city of Little Rock can't use for all the other things it needs to do. If you give them a break, if you give them a subsidy, you either have to tax other people to find that money or you have to stop spending that money on other things in order to make it available. So the people of Arkansas are paying really well, not just the 20 years of economic decline, with the interrupted lives and the interrupted educations and the collapsed infrastructure and the poor schools that meant. But now they're looking forward to having to spend money, taxpayer money, they gave to the state for the things they need, to give a subsidy to a company that's going to bring them maybe in 4 years 400 jobs paying $14 an hour. It takes my breath away. But here's the lesson, the big one. That's how capitalism works. If it's profitable to leave the United States and go to a place like China, they do it. And they'll do it for as long as it's profitable. But if there's a new technology that they can use, One that might be expensive, but they've had 20 years of boosted profits by producing in China, so they can afford it. They can now come back into the United States, employ a small fraction of the people who once had jobs, get a nice fat subsidy out of the public sector to do it, and make even more profits. Because, as the man said, even the cheapest labor market can't compete with us with this technology. What they don't get you by if they bring a poor immigrant to take your job, what they don't get by moving your job to another part of the world where they can pay someone very little, they can get by replacing you with a machine. Whichever one of those is profitable will be pursued. It's a system that is driven by profits. What the consequences are? What are you saying about the future of Arkansas? If you're bringing in jobs at $14 an hour for factory work, what kind of a society do you think you're going to build? What kind of community can sustain itself on that? Especially after 20 years of decline. You must be kidding. If this is the best you can do, Mr. Governor of Arkansas, you've basically thrown in the towel on the future economic development of your state, which you were not elected to do. Here's the reality. Of course, if a machine can produce T-shirts much more quickly and efficiently than the old machine, and that you need fewer labor hours to go with that machine than you once did, the humane, the good thing to do would be to let all the workers have a shorter work day. That's how you would have less work, because you don't need it anymore. That's how to make a technical innovation really help people, by shortening the work week. You're not doing that. You're laying off people. You're destroying the community. You're just doing it to make more money. And why don't you just be honest and admit that's the system you live in? We know it. Why do you have to fake it? And precisely because it's the system we live in, the problem is the system. And if we don't like these results, and Lord knows I hope you don't, then it's the system that has to be changed. We've come to the end of the first half of this program of Economic Update. Please stay with us. We will be right back. And I think you'll find the interview well worth your attention.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, just as I am standing by my bed, they framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe. I didn't die, says Joe. I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's
there you'll find.
Welcome back, friends, to the second half of this economic update. Well, many of you have asked for this, and we've waited a bit, but I'm happy to announce that I have a wonderful guest for this second half. He is Michael Hudson, a professor of economics, like I am and have been for a long time, both of us. He's the author of a new book. It's called J is for Junk Economics, A Guide to Reality in an Age of Deception. Michael Hudson is the author of Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Bondage Destroy the Global Economy. He teaches at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. This book, J is for Junk Economics, is a way of his coming to terms, I think, with the economics profession, and that's what we're going to talk about a good bit in the next half hour. In addition to teaching at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, he is a professor at Peking University in Beijing, the People's Republic of China. His work has been translated into many, many languages, and you can find out more about him at his website, michael-hudson.com. So, my colleague and Professor Hudson, welcome to the program.
It's really good to be here.
Good. All right. Let me get to the nub of things right off at the beginning. Every university, or almost every university in the United States, has a Department of Economics, where students are told they can go and learn about how the economy works and therefore find a good place for themselves in it. But there has been a criticism over the years that the economics departments don't teach how an economy works, but rather provide an elaborate, mathematically elegant justification for the status quo. What do you think?
Well, when I went to school, it's true that the universities did not teach how the economy worked. I went to NYU because all they wanted was my money, not my brains. But I was working my way through on Wall Street. And there's a difference between the undergraduate economics and graduate economics. My BA was from the University of Chicago in Germanic philology and history. And when I registered for the MA, I was told by the department chairman, that's very good. People who study economics as undergraduates usually don't do very well in the field. They're just not very imaginative. It's good you didn't have a math background. There wasn't much mathematics then. There was a money and banking course, and I was working as Chase Manhattan's balance of payments analyst, and I found that everything that was in the textbook was exactly the opposite of what happened. They had the idea that banks lend out savings, and that's how everybody gets rich, and I pointed out banks create credit, that there was a whole series of mythology about money. They don't realize that savings just grow by compound interest. There's an accumulation, and the whole economy is getting more and more debt-ridden, even in the 60s. I got a C-plus in the course because he said that I didn't understand how the banking system worked, that it lent to industry, and industry employs workers carrying their lunch pails in and out of the factories, and everybody gains. And I said, no, the large, most bank loans, 80%, are all mortgage loans to the real estate sector. And after that, to the oil and gas industry and the mining industries. And what these industries get, they get rent, land rent, economic rent, monopoly rent, really much more than profits, and they're not after profits. That's not good enough. There was no discussion at all of the concept of economic rent and unearned income in the curriculum. All of the courses that we took, it wasn't even mathematized then, because if they would have tried to mathematize what economics in the mainstream is all about, you'd think people would laugh it all away. My friend Steve Keen is a mathematician. He wasn't trained in economics, but anybody who is trained in mathematics, as I was trained in statistics on Wall Street, knows that the mathematics that economists use are junk mathematics. The concepts are wrong. It's the concept of garbage in, garbage out. And all of our courses, the graduate school, were about GDP, gross national product, as it was then called, and the whole economy was sort of viewed as something homogeneous, growing and shrinking, but really operating on barter. And everybody earned what they got. So the growth sector at that time were the monopolies, real estate and banking, and that was because bankers and landlords add so much money, so much output to the economy by the effort of collecting interest and collecting rent, and now operating frauds like you've seen in the banks and today's news, Wells Fargo and the others. And by definition, this occurred about 100 years ago. There was a change away from classical economics to say that everybody earns whatever they make or can take home, and they earn their wealth by contributing to output. Right. Instead of, there's no idea that they earn money by taking away what somebody else produces for output, which is really how the real world operates. So I found this was absolutely wonderful. They talked about, my field was balance of payments at that time. And as I said, I worked for Chase. I left Chase for Arthur Andersen. And my job was to make a balance of payments model of the U.S. economy. And I found that this is when there was a balance of payments deficit because of the war in Vietnam. And I was part of a group, Seymour Melman, Terence McCarthy, and myself were the three economists talking about the economic consequences of the Vietnam War. So I, after a year's work at Arthur Andersen, it takes that long to make a big statement, I found the entire balance of payments deficit of the United States is military. And that means that when America runs a deficit today and other central banks hold out treasury bills, that they're Russia, China, other countries are all really financing America's military spending throughout the world. Well, my boss at Arthur Andersen said that, you know, he'd shown a copy to the U.S. government, and that McNamara, Robert McNamara, called him up and said, if you publish Hudson's study, you'll never get another contract job from the government. So they immediately fired me. I took the monograph to NYU, which published it as it was all published and everything. The Federal Reserve responded by writing a whole review of all of the institute that did it at NYU, saying they've lost all credibility with my study. Then I was teaching at the New School, and one of my students worked for the Fed, showed me the internal memo confirming that everything that I said was correct. So I thought, well, okay, we have a you've talked about the dual economy before, you know, the rich people versus the poor. We have a dual kind of economics. One is the kind of economics that people actually working on Wall Street use, and they know that it's all about getting something for nothing. And there's the economics in the textbooks. And that's how a parallel universe would work if it were fair and if everybody really earned everything. And if Goldman Sachs partners really were the most productive in the United States because they earn so much and add so much to GDP. So it's really, I think the economics department that you describe should be part of the literary department. It's really a form of science fiction. It's a parallel universe. And they should put economics, I think, maybe in anthropology, or it should be a branch of mathematics, but you don't want someone who wants to become an economist have anything to do with talking about the real economy. They're talking, it's really, if you look at Paul Samuelson's textbook or almost any modern economics textbook, they're very clear saying the test of good economics is whether it's internally consistent. Well, that's what my literature professors told me as an undergraduate at Chicago. They said the key to a good novel or a good screenplay is it consistent? Is there any hole? You don't like going to a movie and you think, uh-oh, wait a minute, that's not real. It would have all changed. And reality is not a precondition for economics. And in fact, the whole system of Nobel Prizes is given to people who can make the most beautiful, mathematically sophisticated drawing of why the economy is perfectly fair and is in equilibrium and everybody shares as a result of contracts that are all voluntary between companies and their customers and banks and their lenders. And everybody really decides that they want to make the economy just the way it is. And that's why some people are rich and some people are poor.
You know, it's wonderful because I remember, it's wonderful hearing you because I remember when I was a young person going to graduate school in economics and always stumbling at that point where the professor said, the output is divided
in the community among people according to their contribution. Because in it is this enormous value judgment that basically sweeps away all of the struggle, all of the blood, sweat, tears, animosity, all the richness of it, and says that this is a perfectly worked out system. It's all perfect. Everybody gets back what they, the equivalent of what they contribute. And the idea that the landlord who sits on land that he obviously didn't produce, since the land was there before he was, the landlord who collects the rent is contributing. I remember scratching my head. Contributing what? All he has is the right, which he shouldn't have, to withhold that piece of land from the community that needs it, and he extorts from the community that needs it a payment so he makes available something he didn't produce. This notion, which was so obvious to me, had no place in his economics. Remarkable kind of switcheroo. It's almost, I had a professor once, Paul Baran, who used the following joke. He said, it's as if a thief, having stolen your wallet, then says to you, I'm keeping the money in your wallet. And I want you to understand, this is a lesson for you. You have to hold your wallet in a different place. I am going to make your life more successful by having stolen this, and therefore it's appropriate that I take a payment for the improvement of your life that comes, you know, it takes your breath away, this kind of reasoning. But then it can become a whole curriculum.
Well, I think the thief in your story was a chief's gate. I could pull out a gun and say your money is your life. What I'm selling you is your life. And you're holding on to your money instead. This is a voluntary transaction. It's as voluntary as going to the bank.
Yes.
That's exactly it. The idea, now, at least, you mentioned mathematics today. When I was in school in the 60s, it wasn't mathematized back then. What they had was the history of economic thought. And at least in the history of economic thought, they did mention Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, even Marx, very briefly, I think, for what he liked to have for dinner and things like that. Soon after I left, and by the 1970s, all throughout the universities today, the history of economic thought has been dropped from the curriculum and replaced by mathematics. And the mathematics all say exactly what you've just described, that everything is natural, everything is an equilibrium. And when you say equilibrium, it somehow means that what's happened, the crash of 2008 could not have happened. The world we live could not exist according to the mathematics that they use. So now that they've got rid of the history of economic thought, they can pretend that Adam Smith was for this kind of free market, and that John Stuart Mill and all of the busts that they have in the hall of the famous economists all were basically part of a long tradition. And that's not the case at all. There was, as you know, there was a completely different tradition, all from the physiocrats in France to Adam Smith to John Stuart Mill to Marx. And that's really why the last thing that the universities would want would be for students to read Adam Smith and Ricardo and even Malthus or Mill, because the logical conclusion of everything they were saying led up to the last great classical economist, Marx. And the rejection of classical economics really is a rejection of Marxism, because up until that, what every single major economist of the 19th century was talking about, even Ricardo and Malthus, was what do you do about the fact that industrial capitalism isn't really pure? It still has we came out of feudalism, and we have a landlord class, and these landlords inherited the money generation after generation, as you just mentioned, especially in England, this was the problem, and they conquered the land, and Marx called that primitive accumulation. And somehow, industry has to pay to the landlords to produce food, makes England, according to Ricardo, pay workers more and more. And Ricardo said, if we don't lower the rents to the landlords, he did it by free trade, then we're going to have to pay our workers more in order to enable them to pay the rents to the landlords, and we can't compete. And so we've got to
destroy the landlords.
Yes, basically. And at that time, he was a lobbyist for the bankers. He was in Parliament as officially the bank lobbyist of his day. And that's when industry was all, when banks were all in favor of industry, because they had made their money since medieval times by financing international trade.
And governments.
That was the only way they could get around the Christian banning of interest. They called it a foreign exchange fee. And instead of interest, it would be agio, a foreign exchange. Well, all of that has changed today. And now banks, everybody, even in Marx's day, Marx thought it was perfectly logical for industrial capitalism to have banking fund industry and to get rid of the landlords and all of these unnecessary costs of production. I mean, imagine today in America when you have the workers having to get federally guaranteed loans up to 43% of their income goes to pay rent to the landlords. And then 15% is for Social Security and another 10% taxation and, you know, other debts. The result is so much money paid to the landlords, to the banks, to the finance, insurance, and real estate sector that it's about 75% of the paycheck before they even begin to have money to spend on food and clothing. If you gave American workers all the food, all the clothing, all the transportation, everything that they consume for nothing, they still couldn't undersell foreign labor because they have to spend so much money on the rent and to the fire sector. So finance, instead of somehow becoming the final stage of industrial capitalism, as everybody in the 19th century thought, they've rolled it back towards neo-feudalism. And we're going back to feudalism now. So I think economics really should be part of the history department. And you should study the long wave, and you see that Rome fell back. You know, why do societies fall back? It's not just because of bad environment. It's because of basically the Roman historians got it right. It was the creditor class, and it was debt that impoverished the population and forced it into bondage.
Tell me how you think this kind of economics that you are critical of and that you expose in the effective way that you do, why is that there? In other words, why have universities been so slavishly committed to this way of thinking, given that the history of the discipline shows that there were other ways before, given that critics like yourself are making arguments? You might imagine that they would at least allow students to hear the debate about different perspectives, but they don't. It's unbelievable the rareness with which you will encounter a dissident economist, let alone a Marxist, in a major economics department. They not only don't allow it, but they seem perfectly comfortable that one paradigm, theirs, is the exclusive shaper of what students think. And let's remember, those students include the political leaders of a few years later, the journalists of a few years later, the business leaders of a few years later. So they're shaping what you might almost call a dominant ideology. So the question is that functional to the status quo? And in what way? How do you see these things?
Well, Thorstein Veblen answered that question 100 years ago. He wrote a book, The Higher Education in America. He said, well, we're having the universities now funded by wealthy donors, Babbitt-type people. And they want universities to somehow justify their role in the world and depict them as heroes, not as predators. And so you have this, essentially, the economics discipline has turned into a lobbying effort for the Koch brothers, for the rentiers, and for the bankers. And this was true above all at the University of Chicago in the school. And the University of Chicago realized something that Milton Friedman's genius. He recognized that you can't have a free market economics unless you have totalitarian control of the economy and of the educational system. So the first thing that the Chicago boys did when they went into Chile after assassinating president was to close every economics department in the country except for the Catholic University, where they were using the University of Chicago's book. And the University of Chicago people then took control of every major refereed economic journal in the United States. So at the many of our graduates at UMKC are taught Minsk monetary and Marxist economics. They can't get promoted and get hired as professors unless they publish in the refereed journals. And the referees all insist that they describe the economy as the best of all possible worlds, or at least the most inevitable. That, as Margaret Thatcher said, there is no no alternative. And that's the genius of free market economics, that you have to have totalitarian control so that this is the only concept of freedom that people can have. This is Orwellianism. They've read 1984. They've applied it in practice. They know how it works.
Right, so the economics department, just to restate what you're saying, the economics department teaches the joys, the efficiency, the perfectness, or the optimality, to use the terms they like, the optimality of a free market of contesting desires, but in their own economics department, absolute control, no free market, no chance for students to taste the different economic theories and decide for themselves what makes sense to them. Not at all. We have to. The irony there and the contradiction is wonderful to behold. And it's also mirrored in the language. If the world is changing, like the end of the 19th century, then we have robber barons. 100 years later, we have entrepreneurs. The words themselves capture the changing way the same person in the same social role is defined.
Well, you get that every night on television. When the stock market goes up, it's all as if everybody's somehow gaining. And they don't realize that the reason the stock market's going up isn't because it reflects a healthy economy. It's because corporations have given up on the economy. They're buying their own shares. Right. That's what's pushing it all up. And they've decided the market, the boom is over. The economy's not going to grow. We're not going to hire more labor. We're not going to invest. We're going to buy our own shares and just dissolve the company and pay out everything we have and shrink.
You know, I live in New York City, as you do, and I recently, because of schools I went to, I was invited to a group of business leaders, and they said to me over lunch, because I asked the question, what do you think is going on? They looked at me, they smiled, and they said, we're in that phase of the economic system where everybody's job is to grab whatever is not yet nailed down and run. And I thought, wow, for people who are the leaders of their respective industries, that's quite a mentality to have in your mind as a summary statement. Let me ask you a question that is a big one. If economics were to be taught in a way that you would support, that you would enjoy, you would encourage, what would it look like? What would be the economics curriculum that you would think helps people to understand the actual conflicts, struggles, and functioning of today's economy?
Well, I actually have taught economics, so I can tell you how I do it.
Good.
Began teaching national income analysis at the New School graduate faculty in the late 60s and 70s. I began with the history of economic thought to see all the different discussions over rent. And the textbook I used was the very first history of economic thought. It was Marx's Theories of Surplus Value. So that basically was our text. The concept of economic rent, the concept of exploitation, that there are many different kinds of exploitation. Part of it would be that. Also, there's no university that I know of in America that actually teaches how to use the government statistics. In teaching monetary theory, I'd use the Federal Reserve's flow of funds analysis. I'd show the students how to go through the statistics and see where, what are banks actually lending for? You don't have to look at a textbook of, say, they're lending to factories to grow. They're lending to stock for companies to buy their own stock. They're lending to Donald Trump and 80% real estate, 10% for natural resources, and only a teeny little bit for consumer loans, zero for capital formation. Banks don't lend for capital formation. There was a whole debate in the late 19th century about whether banking was going to take the German form, where banks work with government to lend to heavy industry, or the Anglo-American model, where it's just hit and run, quick and miss. And when England entered World War I, their critics of Marx said, we're worried England's going to lose because our banking system is predatory. Germany has a productive banking system, and World War I is going to be fought over what financial system is going to survive to make the future of capitalism. Well, as we all know, it was not Germany and the industrial system. But if you look at, say, late 19th century thought, everybody who was discussing the future, I mean, I would like to call economics futurology or future studies. Everybody all over the political spectrum thought, what kind of socialism are we going to have? Right. They all saw capitalism as evolving into socialism. There was Christian socialism. There was libertarian socialism. Right. There were the Henry George people. There were Marxists. And everybody saw that it was a period of transformation, and they all agreed that the dynamic of markets, if there was real competition, would be for the most efficient system to drive out the inefficient system, and that was going to be socialism of one form or another. And just to read that, you see that you don't have to reinvent the wheel to analyze where we're going today. That there was there were brilliant people discussing this in the 1880s, 1890s. Just to familiarize students with that is the takeoff point. Instead of beginning with Paul Samuelson or Gregory Mankiw or today, mathematics, pretty soon I found that my most imaginative students at the New School wanted to drop out. They said, we wanted to study economics to see how the world works. Yes. And instead, it's how to do mathematics. We're not interested in that. That's not the world, especially this mathematics. I want to get it back into a historical basis and to discuss how the economy is changing. The problem with mathematics is it's statistical, and you assume the environment is constant. If the environment changes, if there's a change in the structure, then the formulas don't work anymore. But what's interesting is that the structure is changing. So if you want to make a revolution, or if you want to change the world, that's what you have to look at, the process of change and the dynamics. That's what's made Marx so popular, and why so many people are still reading him and not Paul Samuelson.
On that note, thank you very much. I wish we had more time. Let's have you back. And we'll continue the conversation about the gap between the economic reality and what is taught, which is so important for people. I want to thank you for being a partner with Economic Update. Make use of our website. Make use of this program. Share it. We do that already with truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis. We'd like to be partners with you as well. I look forward to speaking with you again next week. Thing gonna change, 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 change. Thing gonna change.
Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio. TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Ira Helfand and Alan Robach. Nuclear Blast and Nuclear Winter. How nuclear war will kill the attacker as well as the attacked. Dr. Ira Helfand explains what happens when a nuclear weapon hits the center of an American city. Professor Alan Robach is the leading expert on nuclear winter. He says that the firestorm of the burning city raises a cloud of dust into the stratosphere, where it circles and eventually covers the globe for up to a decade. Even a limited nuclear war using less than 1% of the existing weapons will bring darkness and famine to the Northern Hemisphere. A U.S. president threatening casually fire, fury, and power the likes of which this world has never seen before displays ignorance of nuclear physics as well as of Republican politics. When Ronald Reagan, in the middle of his Cold War campaign against the Soviet Union, suddenly showed interest in meeting Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev to talk about the reduction of nuclear weapons, the world took notice. Later, Reagan and Gorbachev made a joint statement. They said, "Nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought." What is it like when a city is hit by a nuclear weapon? Dr. Ira Helfand is co-president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. IPPNW is a nonpartisan federation of national medical groups in 64 countries. They represent tens of thousands of doctors, medical students, health workers, and concerned citizens, and they share the common goal of creating a world free from the threat of nuclear annihilation. Dr. Ira Helfand is one of their acclaimed speakers. He was recorded at Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston in April 2016.
We're all familiar with the image of Hiroshima after the nuclear bombing there. And we have to understand this is not what the world will look like after modern nuclear war. Hiroshima was one small bomb, about 15 kilotons, 15,000 tons of TNT. A modern attack on a city like Boston would involve not one bomb, but perhaps 10 or 12, each of them anywhere from 10 to 50 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. It's difficult to describe 10 or 15 bombs going off all at the same time, so I'm going to use a model of a single explosion, a single 20 megaton bomb, 20 million tons of TNT. The megatonnage is actually a little bit bigger than would probably fall on Boston. The destruction that I'm going to describe is actually an underestimate because you cause more damage by spreading out the bombs over more efficiently over a large area. But I think it gives an adequate understanding of the magnitude of the danger that we face. So a 20 megaton bomb going off over the State House in downtown. Within 1/1,000th of a second, a fireball would form, reaching out for 2 miles in every direction, engulfing everything, including the building we're sitting in a fireball, which the temperatures within this would rise to up to 20 million degrees Fahrenheit, which is hotter than the surface of the sun, and everything would be vaporized. The buildings, the people, the trees, the upper level of the earth itself would disappear. To a distance of 4 miles in every direction, the blast would generate overpressures of 25 pounds per square inch and winds in excess of 600 miles per hour. Mechanical forces of that magnitude could destroy anything that people can build. Underground shelters collapse when they're exposed to pressures this great. To a distance of 6 miles in every direction, the heat would be so intense that automobiles would melt. To a distance of 10 miles in every direction, the winds would still be greater than 200 miles per hour. The blast pressure is still greater than 10 pounds per square inch. Forces of that magnitude will level masonry buildings, wooden frame buildings. A building like this would see the walls and the floors swept out, there'd be a steel skeleton left behind. To a distance of 16 miles in every direction, the heat would still be so intense that everything flammable would burn. Paper, cloth, gasoline, wood, heating oil, plastic, it would all ignite, causing hundreds of thousands of fires, which over the next half hour would coalesce into a firestorm, 32 miles across, covering over 800 square miles. Within this entire area, the temperatures would rise to 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit. All of the oxygen would be consumed, and every living thing would die. In the case of Boston, we're talking about something on the order of 3 million people dead in a half an hour. Beyond this firestorm, the destruction would continue. To a distance of 19 miles, people standing outside would suffer third-degree burns on any exposed skin. To a distance of 21 miles, second-degree burns. To a distance of 40 miles, people who turned reflexly to look at the sudden flash of light would be blinded. There would be hundreds of thousands of casualties, all kinds of injuries. People blinded, as I mentioned. People made deaf by having their eardrums ruptured. People suffering penetrating wounds as shards of glass flew through the air. People with mechanical injuries and crush injuries from being thrown themselves through the air or being trapped under collapsing buildings. And most especially, there would be people with burns. Tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people with major burn injuries. They would all need urgent medical attention, and that care would not be available. In the entire United States, there are about 2,000 burn beds. Here in the Boston area, there are three institutions, between them 46 burn beds for hundreds of thousands of patients. And all three of these facilities are in the zone of complete destruction. In fact, almost all of the hospitals in the metropolitan area would be destroyed. Most of the doctors would be dead. Most of the nurses would be dead. There'd be no electricity to power EKG machines, X-ray machines. What little supplies were not destroyed, blood products, antibiotics, pain medicine, would be used up in the first minutes of dealing with this catastrophe. There'd be no EMS system to transport people to hospitals. And in fact, the vast majority of the people who were injured would also die. And if this attack were part of a large-scale war between the United States and Russia, this same level of destruction would be visited on every major city in both countries. A study which we published in 2002 showed that if only 300 of the 1,500 warheads that the Russians maintain on hair trigger alert hit urban targets in the United States, 75 to 100 million people would be dead in the first half hour. In addition, the entire economic infrastructure of the country would be destroyed. All the things that we depend on to maintain our population. We're not hunter-gatherers or subsistence farmers. We need an intact society to live, and that society would be gone. The internet would be gone, the electric grid, the public health system, the food distribution system. None of this would exist anymore. And it is probable that in the months following this nuclear war, the vast majority of the American and Russian people who did not die in the initial attack would also die from exposure, from starvation, from radiation poisoning, from epidemic illness. All told, perhaps 500 million people. And as my colleague, Professor Roebuck, will explain in his talk, these direct effects are only a part, and incredibly enough, only a small part of the damage that will be caused by nuclear war. So why talk about this? Well, for two reasons. First, because if we do not take action, this is the future that will be. This is going to happen. We've been told for 25 years that we don't need to worry about nuclear war between the United States and Russia. Well, even during that period, we knew that there could be an accident. And there have been at least five occasions since the early 1980s when either Moscow or Washington prepared to launch nuclear war in the mistaken belief that it was already under attack. But in the last two or three years, we've also come to understand that the assurances we received that deliberate nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia was impossible, those assurances were hollow. The crisis in Ukraine has made it clear that the United States and Russia could end up on opposite sides of a military conflict. And since that crisis began, there's been unbelievable nuclear saber-rattling on both sides. The Russians have threatened repeatedly to use nuclear weapons in response to this crisis, and NATO, for its part, has conducted military exercises very close to Russian borders using nuclear-capable forces. It is an extremely dangerous situation and has led leaders on both sides to warn that the danger of nuclear war today is greater than at any time in the past, greater than it was during the 1980s. That's one reason why we need to talk about this. The other and more important reason is that this is not the future that must be. We don't have to go down this route. Nuclear weapons are not a force of nature. They're not an act of God. We've built them with our own hands, and we know how to take them apart. All that has been missing is the political will to do this. This is a tremendous responsibility. It is a huge burden that sits on our shoulders. We are literally responsible for the fate of the Earth. But if this is a great burden, I think it is also something of a gift that has been given to us. Every one of us wants to do something good with our life. We have been given the opportunity to save the world, and that is a very good thing to do. It says in Deuteronomy, it's recorded in Deuteronomy, that God said, "Behold, I have put before you life and death. Therefore, choose life, that you and your children might live." That is literally the choice before us today, before all of humanity. And so let us, in our work today, dedicate ourselves to choosing wisely and to acting with courage and determination so that indeed our children might live. I want to thank you for coming to this meeting. This is a difficult topic to talk about. It's a difficult way to spend a day. But even more, I want to thank you for the work which I know you're going to do after today. No one of us is expected to do this job all by ourselves, but every one of us is expected to do that part of the job which falls to us to do. And that is our individual responsibility in this situation. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Ira Helfand. He's co-president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. For almost 30 years, they have campaigned to abolish nuclear weapons. Along with Helen Caldicott's organization, Physicians for Social Responsibility, they have moved many to understand the effects of nuclear weapons on human beings and the world. In February 2015, Dr. Helen Caldicott organized a symposium on the dynamics of possible nuclear extinction. One of the presenters was Professor Alan Robock. He spoke on nuclear famine and nuclear winter, climatic effects of nuclear war. He is part of my introduction to the original broadcast. Ever since the astrophysicist Carl Sagan coined the term of nuclear winter in 1983, an additional global risk became evident. Even a limited nuclear exchange would pose a grave danger to all life. If it was not by nuclear blast, fire, and radiation, it would be by nuclear winter. High-altitude dust clouds that spread through the stratosphere can block the sun for years and even decades over large areas of the planet and threaten the global ecology and with it the sources of food. In retrospect, two factors played a huge role in steps on the road to limit and abolish nuclear weapons: a vibrant anti-nuclear movement and scientists who had the courage to speak out. And Alan Robock, today's speaker, is one of them. Looking back at the 1980s, scientists then were supported by one of the largest and effective social movements in modern time. Some claim that in the U.S. by numbers, it exceeded the civil rights movement. Some say that the test ban treaties and the reduction of nuclear weapons would never have happened unless there had been a decade-long period of activism beginning way before the 1980s. And it was an international campaign. In the UK, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, CND, was founded in 1957 in the wake of widespread fear of nuclear conflict and the radiation dangers of nuclear tests. Professor Alan Robock was one of the acclaimed speakers at the symposium on the dynamics of possible nuclear extinction, organized by Dr. Helen Caldicott. Here is Helen Caldicott. She introduces Alan Robock.
The next speaker is Alan Robock, Distinguished Professor of Climate Science in the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. His areas of expertise include climatic effects of nuclear war, effects of volcanic eruptions on climate, and soil moisture variations. His honours include being a Fellow of the American Geophysical Union, the American Meteorological Society, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Professor Robock is a lead author of the 2013 Working Group of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Alan Robock.
Thanks very much, Helen, for inviting me. Well, here's our beautiful planet. But after a nuclear war, it might look like this, with a cloud of smoke covering the Earth, blocking out the sun and making it cold and dark at the Earth's surface. There are two types of targets, ground bursts, and so the cities would burn and firestorms would build. Ground bursts also produce dust, and in one case, the sunlight gets absorbed. In another case, it gets reflected, but that means very little sunlight would reach the ground, and that would cause rapid large drops in surface temperature. This would be devastation to agriculture and natural ecosystems. The smoke in the atmosphere also heats the upper atmosphere, which then destroys ozone, and that would mean a lot more ultraviolet radiation reaching the ground, also which would be devastating for life. So this produces what we call nuclear winter, with cold, dry, dark conditions at the surface, more ultraviolet, producing crops dying and global famine. The first idea of this was by a paper by Paul Crutzen and John Birks, and then climate model simulations of the response were done by both Russians, Alexandrov and Stenchikov, and Americans, Turco et al. And I published a paper the next year showing the long-term effects. And the nuclear freeze movement was going on at the same time. And then the nuclear arms race ended. And this science was part of the story of why the nuclear arms race ended. The Soviet Union ended 5 years later, so it wasn't the end of the Soviet Union that ended the arms race. I'd also like to point out that the number by 2017 is not zero. We still will have 5,000 nuclear weapons on the planet, and that's still enough to produce nuclear winter. So the problem has not been solved. Why do I think we scientists had a role? Well, you can ask the people that made the decision, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. Reagan said, a great many reputable scientists are telling us such a war could end up in no victory for anyone because we'd wipe out Earth as we know it. If you think back to natural calamities back in the last century, in the 1800s, volcanoes, we saw the weather so changed there was snow in July in many temperate countries. And they call it the year in which there was no summer. Now, if one volcano can do that, what are we talking about with the whole nuclear exchange, the nuclear winter that scientists are talking about? It's possible. And Gorbachev said models made by Russian and American scientists showed a nuclear war would result in a nuclear winter that could be extremely destructive to all life on Earth. The knowledge of that was a great stimulus to us. So both these men who made the decision had this information from both Russian and American scientists telling them the same story. That was a powerful message. So that was 30 years ago. Why am I even telling you about it? I want to ask two questions. The Cold War and the arms race are over. Could the remaining nuclear arsenal still produce nuclear winter with temperatures below freezing? And now there are not just two nuclear nations, there are nine. What if a couple of the new nuclear nations, say India and Pakistan, had a war on the other side of the world? How would that affect us? So the answers to these questions are, yes, the current arsenal can still produce a nuclear winter. And it would last much longer than we thought, decades. And a small nuclear war would not produce winter, that is, the temperatures wouldn't get below freezing, but it would be terrible direct effects, and there would be severe impacts on global agriculture for more than a decade. Now, unfortunately, we know that cities can burn. There was an earthquake in San Francisco in 1906, and Jack London was out on San Francisco Bay. He wrote, within an hour after the earthquake, the shock of the smoke of San Francisco's burning was a lurid tower visible 100 miles away. And for 3 days and nights, this lurid tower swayed in the sky, reddening the sun, darkening the day, and filling the land with smoke. And it produced a firestorm and pumped the smoke up into the upper atmosphere. All the buildings were gone except for some of the stone ones. This is what one of the survivors of Hiroshima remembers, which is the smoke and the fires. So we have this example of cities burning and producing smoke. There are about 16,400 nuclear weapons in the world now, as of August 2014. Russia has about 8,000, the U.S. about 7,000. All these other countries have a couple hundred. Why did they stop? Why did they only have a couple hundred? How many nuclear weapons do you have to put on your enemy to deter them from attacking you? One. Okay, maybe two if the first one doesn't work. So why do we still have thousands? I mean, the U.S. and Russia could immediately go down to 200 each and not lose any of their deterrent ability, even if it were a deterrent. Now, Max talked about, Ted also, about how close we've come several times. What about this time? Imagine you're Pakistani air defense and you see an attack coming in over the horizon. And you're a nuclear nation. Who do you think would be attacking you? Would you guess it was the United States, or maybe you'd think it was India? So did we almost start a nuclear war by going to get Osama bin Laden? We didn't, fortunately. But along the Kashmiri border, there are always disputes between Indians and Pakistanis. Imagine a skirmish there escalating due to poor communication, misunderstanding, panic, problem with the computer. In fact, last year I was at the IPPNW meeting in Kazakhstan, and I picked up the newspaper that morning in the hotel. Four people were killed when nuclear-armed rivals India and Pakistan traded heavy fire across the border early Saturday. This happens all the time. We've been really lucky that this, again, hasn't escalated into something worse. So we decided to look at what the climatic effects of such a war would be. So we took 50 Hiroshima-sized weapons and put them on the 50 targets in each country that produced the largest amount of smoke. And for India, this would produce 3.5 million tons of smoke. For Pakistan, 3 million, 6.5 million. We said, let's be conservative. Let's put 5 million tons of smoke into the upper atmosphere and see what the climate response would be. This is much less than 1% of our current global nuclear arsenal, 0.03%. Of course, it would be a terrible direct effect. 20 million people would die directly. So here's a movie of where the smoke would go, and most of it would be heated and go up into the stratosphere, the region above where there's weather, so there wouldn't be any rain to wash it out, and it would last for more than a decade, and it would cover the whole world. If you graph the climate response on a graph of global average temperature, so it would be a couple degrees colder, it wouldn't be winter temperatures, but this would be the climate change unprecedented in recorded human history, colder than the Little Ice Age. Now, two other climate models have recently done a similar calculation to make sure this is not dependent on one climate model. All three found basically the same result. This is the climate model at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which is a much more detailed and also includes the effects of ozone. Our first calculation showed that the temperature would go down by 1.5 degrees Celsius, about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And the Swiss model showed similar results. The NCAR model had the smoke last longer. It calculated in more detail in the stratosphere, and actually it would last for a couple decades. All right, so a couple degrees. What does that mean? So we said, let's take this and let's go to places where they grow food and apply the change of temperature, the change of precipitation, the change of sunlight, and calculate how crops would grow. First of all, the ozone would be depleted, and so now we worry about the ozone hole around Antarctica. This would be a global ozone hole with excess ultraviolet, and we haven't even had time yet to look at the impacts of the UV. All of those three climate models, looking at how the production of the main food crops in China, the country that grows the most food, would change. And so this is for 10 years, And for rice, it would be down by 20%. For winter wheat, 40%. And this is only in the first decade. So let me summarize this. In the U.S., corn would go down by 20%, soybeans 15%, rice would go down by 25%, wheat by 40%. And it would last for more than a decade. And so you can imagine people hoarding food, world food trade collapsing. So what's new in this work? A nuclear war between any nuclear states using much less than 1% of the current nuclear arsenal could produce climate change unprecedented in recorded human history. Such a, quote, small nuclear war could reduce food production by 20 to 40% for a decade. So what are the policy implications then? Immediate American and Russian reductions of to the same arsenals of the other nuclear nations, about 200 each, would prevent nuclear winter. We wouldn't be able to produce enough smoke to actually cause temperatures to go below freezing and sentence the entire world to famine. But if we want to prevent the famine that would result, maybe a billion people would die from a war between India and Pakistan because of the cutting the food supply, then we have to get rid of all the nuclear weapons. Now, Carl Sagan, who was one of the leaders about talking about this in the 1980s, said, for myself, I would far rather have a world in which the climatic catastrophe cannot happen, independent of the vicissitudes of leaders, institutions, and machines. This seems to me to be elementary planetary hygiene, as well as elementary patriotism. So elementary planetary hygiene demands that we eliminate the nuclear weapons much faster than they're being eliminated now. I'll just end with another quote from Dr. Seuss. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing's going to get better. It's not. Thanks.
That was Alan Robock. He's an American climatologist and currently teaches in the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. He's an IPCC lead author and was a member of the organization when it was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. You heard a TUC radio special in response to the threatened use of nuclear weapons. Ira Helfand and Alan Robock, Nuclear Blast and Nuclear Winter. Nuclear war will kill the attacker as well as the attacked. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
To Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So the right to stay home actually includes both of these rights. It includes the right to an alternative to being forced into migration, but it also means that if you do decide to leave home and to work as a migrant in another country, you have a right to social equality. You have some political rights. You have economic rights.
That's the voice of David Bacon. On this week's show, we speak to David about his latest book, The Right to Stay Home, How U.S. Policy Drives Mexican Migration. So stay tuned.
We're very privileged to be joined by author David Bacon. He is the author of Illegal People, How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Immigrants. Welcome to our show, David.
Hi, Sylvia.
It's so great to hear your voice. Now, we are looking at a world that is, filled with struggle. Wherever we look, whether it's Greece, Spain, Latin America, we see people rising against the capitalist system. And we often are presented with very limited options, either austerity or economic collapse. What is the story that is missing from this very narrow perspective of how the world is organized and how the world can function?
Well, I think that the reason why there's such an enormous push for austerity is because we still live in a world that does not look that different from the old colonial world when the U.S., European countries, Japan, divided up the world and then proceeded to basically take the wealth that was in the countries that were the colonies and bring it to the metropolitan countries. So, and that has enormous consequences. And what I'm thinking about, Sylvia, is the recent publicity that we've seen in the media about the deaths of people in Europe, the people who are especially crossing the Mediterranean, trying to reach Lampedusa and Sicily, and also people who are now traveling overland through Turkey and then into Greece and then up through the Balkans into Western Europe. Part of the reason why people are coming is because of the wars that are devastating countries like Syria, many of the countries of North Africa, but these wars are themselves the product of trying to maintain an unjust world order. In other words, if we look at Libya, for instance, I think that the intervention in Libya that led to the downfall of Muammar Gaddafi, now looking for the moment at what kind of regime he had in Libya, but the main reason for the intervention was to essentially expropriate and continue to expropriate the oil in Libya. And as a result of that, Libya has turned into a country that is very violent, one in which there are different armed groups fighting each other, and the oil in Libya is going to wind up back in the hands of large corporations. So the purpose of the intervention really was to capture and maintain control of that oil, in other words, the natural resources. And when you look throughout Africa and the Middle East, you see the same kind of thing going on. You know, the oil of Nigeria winds up coming to Europe. The profits from the sale of it stay in Europe. They don't go back to Nigeria, at least not a lot of them. And Nigerians, in the meantime, are forced into migration to Europe. And so you find people who are, you know, selling knockoff handbags in the plazas in the streets of Rome because they can't make a living at home. So the consequences of the sort of the ripoff of the resources of Africa is, you know, that the people of those countries can't really make a living there and wind up coming to the countries that were their original colonizers. And then the wars that get fought to ensure that this situation doesn't change also produce an enormous amount of displacement. You know, we have millions of people who have been leaving Iraq and leaving Syria, and these are really wars that are fought in order to make sure that Western Europe, the United States, continue to kind of occupy the dominant positions in an economic world order.
You know, when you talk about not only the implications of maintaining a system that is so inequitable and unjust, you know, that produces so much suffering and so much violence. In many ways, the violence is both the military intervention, but it's also the economic warfare against the working class. Can we talk a little bit about the numbers of immigrants that this this policy of globalization, and to me it's neoliberalism really, because globalization, the world, there's always been people, you know, mobilizing on the global scale, but this liberalization of capital and this idea of companies having the right to impose practices that devalue workers' productivity, that devalue the worth of what, you know, one worker produces in one area and poses them against another worker, say Mexico and Canada, for instance. So I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about the relationships that create, that are maintaining. How are these relationships not only naturalize the violence against the people, but also the double edge of criminalization of the workers who, who escape those conditions and come to the U.S. or Europe?
Well, first of all, in terms of just the numbers, the number of people who are living outside the countries where they were born, according to the UNHCR, the UN High Commission on Refugees, is about 300 million people in the world today. But I think that's really actually a pretty gross underestimate. And it also doesn't really take into account the internal migration. In other words, people who are displaced and forced to leave home but don't necessarily cross borders. You know, there are, for instance, hundreds of millions of people in China who are migrating from the countryside in China to the cities, essentially because of the difference in the standard of living in China between the countryside and the cities. And so this is a migration, in other words, economic migration as well, too. I think that this was recently highlighted by President Obama, who went to visit the homeland of his father, Kenya, on his recent trip to Africa, and, you know, talked about the need for modernizing the economies of Africa, and then especially of Eastern Africa and Kenya. The reality is that just 3 years ago, Kenya was presented with what was called an economic partnership agreement between Kenya and the European Union. And essentially, this agreement would have allowed large European corporations to operate freely in Kenya. In other words, to dump manufactured goods, for instance, on the market in Kenya and prevent the growth of a native industry in Kenya itself, as well as to hold down the prices of agricultural goods and to serve as sort of like a dumping ground for surplus agricultural products from Europe. So Kenya originally refused to sign that agreement and then was told by European countries that they would impose extremely high tariffs and other customs duties on its exports to Europe, and the economy of Kenya, like most developing countries, has become dependent on markets now in wealthy countries. So that was a very, very powerful threat to make, and eventually the Kenyan government surrendered and signed that agreement. And that's no, you know, in no coincidence, you know, Kenyans are arriving in Europe and in even in the United States today as migrants, essentially for economic reasons. So again, you know, this is the sort of the shaping of the economies of developing countries for the interests of, you know, large corporations, with the governments of, you know, the United States and European governments, and Canada does the same thing, especially under under Harper these days, has essentially the same policy. You know, Canadian mining companies, for instance, are the main mining companies operating now in Mexico and in Central America, causing enormous environmental devastation to rural communities, and again, resulting in the displacement of people. So what happens to people when they become displaced in this way is they then become part of the workforce in wealthy countries and developed countries, Europe, United States, Canada, Japan, and so forth. And that workforce, the place where they enter the workforce is at the bottom. In other words, they become some of the lowest paid workers working in some of the most dangerous and unpleasant conditions. And this kind of position that immigrant workers find themselves in is reinforced by the lack of legal status for many of those migrants. You know, in the United States, we have probably about 12 million people here who don't have any kind of legal status. What that means is that it's easy for employers to threaten people and to tell people that, you know, if they don't work an extra hour of overtime without getting overtime pay, that the employer will fire them because of their immigration status, which is happening quite a lot. And even worse than that, people can wind up becoming deportable. And we also have programs that bring people from those countries to metropolitan countries as low-wage labor. Canada and the United States both have large guest worker programs, which essentially treat people who are coming to Canada and the U.S. as being workers who are going to work for wages that are at the bottom, people who don't acquire the right to live permanently in either of these two, our two countries, and who basically have a kind of a social and political status which excludes them from the rights and the protections that other workers have. So this is a very conscious effort, essentially, to channel the people who are being displaced, in other words, people who can't really survive in their countries of origin, into places in the economies of wealthy countries where their labor can be put to good use, and at a very low pay.
You know, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, because, I mean, many Canadians and a lot of Americans, I presume, also. But when you talk to workers, they say, you know, well, it makes sense that a worker should come here with a visa, a working visa. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this, the significance of this policy that invites workers as so-called guest workers, and the implication that this has for labor organizations in Canada and the U.S., and because it is a double sword for the immigrants. You know, as I've experienced, many of the immigrants are told they're welcome to come here, but that so-called guest working visa also indicates a kind of double-tier system for workers. And I wonder if you could maybe touch on the significance for our labor movements in North America, and why it's important for us to not only acknowledge the inequalities that cause people to be displaced, to cause people to leave their countries of origin and face such marginal and unsafe conditions.
The key question to look at here is, you know, what the conditions of the visa are. In other words, what kind of rights does do visa holders have? Up there in Vancouver, there's a very important organization, Justicia for Migrant Workers, which for a long time has said that the people who are arriving in Canada on guest worker visas should be given the right to stay in Canada, to have their families with them, to basically live in a kind of social status that is the same as anybody else in Canada. And there are organizations like the Frente Indígena de Organizaciones Binacionales in the United States that advocates for the same kind of thing here. The problem with the guest worker visa is that essentially what it does is it does two things. First of all, it sets up a system in which employers go and recruit workers in their countries of origin. And as they say, you know, who pays the musicians, you know, calls the tune. So, in other words, that if people are brought to the U.S. or to Canada by employers, those employers bring them with the expectation, and not just the expectation, but with the legal requirement that the people that they bring work for them. So, in other words, it's not a free situation in which people can kind of look for a job and find one wherever they want, you know, and looking essentially for the best-paying job. These are workers who then are brought to Canada and the U.S. and who are held in that kind of employment status in which their wages are at the bottom. They're temporary arrangements. In other words, you don't have the right to stay in Canada. You don't have the right to stay in the United States. When your work contract is up, you have to leave. And if you lose your job, if your employer decides to fire you, for instance, because you join a union, which has happened in nurseries and greenhouses in Ambie, then you lose your ability to stay. You lose your visa. So that's why they're called work visas, is because your ability to stay in the country is connected to your work and to your job. The other kind of visa is one that allows people to become permanent residents. In other words, that says that even though you're not a citizen, you can live in Canada and the United States. You can live where you want. You can work or you cannot work as you want. You can work wherever you want, and you have the same rights to join unions. You can fight for higher wages. There are still some restrictions in the United States, especially because people not having citizenship status, they can't vote, which is a very big problem for us because in certain areas of the United States, we have many, many, many thousands of workers who are not citizens and who can't vote. And consequently, the political structure, the areas where people are living is dominated by their employers rather than by workers themselves. I'm thinking especially of the rural areas in California here. Nevertheless, a permanent residence visa, what the United States is called the green card, is a kind of visa that gives people rights that a work visa and a guest worker does not. That's why employers like guest worker programs. In fact, that's why there's a big push on in both of our countries to expand these programs and to bring more and more workers. They are especially problematic for unions because what happens essentially is that when workers in the country on guest worker visas get upset and decide that they don't like the wages that they are being paid and decide that they want to organize a union like the United Food and Commercial Workers, which has organized some of the greenhouses and nurseries in British Columbia, employers fire those workers and then proceed to deport them with the help of the Mexican consulate. In other words, the Mexican consulate will go to guest workers and say, you know, don't go out on strike. Don't cause problems. You know, don't speak out, because if you do that, you're going to make these programs much less attractive to the Canadian government and to Canadian employers. And so that's a big problem for unions, because what it really means is that you have a workforce that is very fearful of the risks that are involved in organizing because of what conceivably can happen to people.
David, we've been talking about the impact that globalization has had and how this deepening of poverty not only forces people to migrate, but the kind of insecurity that this creates for workers worldwide. Can we talk a little bit about your book, The Right to Stay Home? What inspired you to write this book?
Well, the reason why it's called The Right to Stay Home, Sylvia, is because there is a growing movement. Well, in the case of this book, what I'm especially looking at is Mexico and especially the state of Oaxaca. But this movement exists in other countries as well, too, especially, for instance, the Philippines and some others, in which people are saying, first of all, that they want to have an alternative to being forced into migration because of the lack of any other way for families and for communities to survive economically. So in Oaxaca, for instance, people were very, very strongly affected by the North American Free Trade Agreement because it allowed U.S. corporations to dump corn on the Mexican market at such a low price that it essentially made it impossible for farmers in Oaxaca to grow corn and sell it for a price that would pay for the cost of growing it. And the big irony, of course, is that corn cultivation started in Oaxaca thousands of years ago. So here we are forcing off of the land people who were responsible for the fact that we're able to eat corn to begin with. But in those communities, people are saying, well, that something has to change here, that this system is not a fair and a just system, that people should be able to grow up and live and have a decent life in Oaxaca, which means in this case that there would have to be higher prices for agricultural products. It would mean restricting foreign corporations. It would mean getting rid of the North American Free Trade Agreement. But people were also saying that, you know, they need the same basic things that all working people need: good schools, a health care system, jobs, and so forth. And in order to get those in Oaxaca, people need political change. So the movements that are talking about this, like the Frente Indígena, are also movements that are calling for political change. You could say that the Zapatistas were calling for the same thing when they rose up in rebellion in Chiapas in 1994. So the right to stay home really means the right for an alternative to forced migration. Now, we're talking about communities that are very dependent on migration, because the world has advanced quite a bit from the time when people first started leaving their homes in Oaxaca looking for some other way of earning a living. So you have communities in Oaxaca in which many, many, many family members are already working in the United States and in Canada, for that matter. And so the right to stay home is also goes along with the rights of migrants. So these communities are saying that if we leave home, we have a right to be treated with dignity and respect in the countries that we go to and work. We have the right to make a decent wage. We have the right to join a union. We have a right not to be deported or to be thrown into some kind of detention center. But we also have the right to decide whether or not we want to migrate to begin with. In other words, migration should be a voluntary process and not one that's forced on people. So the right to stay home actually includes both of these rights. It includes the right to an alternative to being forced into migration, but it also means that if you do decide to leave home and to work as a migrant in another country, you have a right to social equality. You have some political rights. You have economic rights. So this is really, I think, a not exactly a new way of looking at migration, but it's one that I think is a very humanistic way of looking at migration. This is a sort of a point of view that is arising from people themselves and solutions that are being voiced by those communities that are most involved in the system of migration as it is in the world today.
I also think that it's important to note that while the struggle today seems to be one that it's an uphill, you know, mode, right? When we look at Greece, when we look at Latin America, when we look at many of the economic coups that are happening worldwide, it would seem that our struggles are perhaps unfruitful. But I think your book reflects that this growing movement is an exemplary of how connected we all are, you know, as workers, as people worldwide, in this ideal of a world with justice, a world with dignity. And I think if there is one concept that perhaps embraces the work that you do, is that of dignity, that every human being has inherent value, and that we all have do better, you know, when we all treat each other with that dignity, with that, you know, inherent value. How can people access your work? How can people get involved and become catalysts of social change in our communities?
You know, commercial workers in Canada and British Columbia is very much involved in organizing, helping immigrant workers to organize unions. So that's one way. And then right across the border, there's a big organizing effort, including a number of strikes that have taken place this year in Bellingham, near Bellingham, by Oaxacan migrant workers at a ranch called Sukuma Farms. And they set up an independent union called Familias Unidas por la Justicia, and they're calling for a boycott of Driscoll Berries because Driscoll is the corporation that's responsible for the problems that they're facing at work. So that's another way that you can help as well, too.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is David Bacon. He is a beautiful writer, and his books are amazing. His latest book, The Right to Stay Home, How U.S. Policy Drives Mexican Migration. Thank you so much for being with us. And give us our website, your website once more, so people know how to access your books.
Sure. It's like my name, dbacon@igc.org.
Thank you again. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.